Members, we'll call the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform to order. And members, we do have a quorum present. The first order of business would be to move the minutes for March 16th. Do I have a motion to move? Representative Baker moves the motion, or the minutes for March 16th. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, first order of the business of the day, actually now we're on the second order of business with our first bill up, House File 2803, Representative Zerwas. And just really briefly to give members a roadmap, we have a good-sized agenda today, and so we will be meeting for the regularly scheduled time up until 4:30, recessing, and then coming back at 6:45 back in this same room, members. And I apologize for that. We tried to get another room sooner, but that was what was available. So with that, Representative Zerwas will move his bill that House File 2803 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. We have the bill in front of us. Two-year bill, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2803 is actually a public safety bill. It deals with 72-hour holds and interactions with law enforcement agencies from a facility following an individual being placed on a 72-hour hold. The bill has two components. It requires that when someone's taken into custody and placed with the facility, that the police officer, health officer who makes the application for the 72-hour hold shall provide the officer's name, the agency that employs the officer, and the telephone number or other contact information. And then subsequently, and to the meat of the bill deals with individuals that are discharged during the 72 hours of the 72-hour hold, or if the person leaves the facility without the consent of the head of the treatment facility. And so basically, it's if someone is found to be no longer need to be kept there, so they're discharged, or if someone leaves on their own, that law enforcement is then contacted so that the appropriate safety measures can be taken. Sometimes we have public safety issues where someone is not behaving appropriately and perhaps erratically and could be a danger to themselves or others. They're then released within that 72-hour period. A family member might not be aware of that release, and there's been instances in Minnesota and other areas where that person has then returned to the home or a place of business or some other known individual to that person without law enforcement being given notice of their release, and unfortunate things have resulted as a result of that. I have one testifier here today, Chief Wolf from the St. Anthony Police Department, and he can talk a little bit about law enforcement and public safety implications of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Thanks for being here. If you could just introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Chief John Ohl with the St. Anthony Police Department, Madam Chair, members. We just became aware of this just during my tenure as the president of Hennepin County Chiefs of Police Association, the actual law that's on the books right now. And I met with Leah Kaiser, who works in public health at Hennepin County, as well as Bill Neiman, who's an attorney at Hennepin County that deals with the four major hospitals. We toured the hospitals and met with the hospital administration, and everybody wants to assist law enforcement in these notification processes, but two things came up that made it difficult for them, or at least that they thought they needed some clarification for. It was very clear in the current state law that the hospital must notify law enforcement if the person is released prior to the expiration of a 72-hour hold. The two odd things that came up were, one, what if they're triaged and released prior to being placed on that hold, or two, what if they voluntarily take themselves into the 72-hour hold? In those two instances, the hospital staff felt that the statute needed some clarification, and that's what we're here asking for today.
Okay, and members, before I go to questions, I'll just see, is there anyone else in the audience for the bill or with concerns about the bill? Not seeing any. Members, are there any questions for the author or the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerwas, this sounds completely reasonable to me. My only real question is this part about a person leaving the facility without the consent of the head of the treatment facility. when somebody's on a 72-hour hold, I mean, that means that against their will, they're not supposed to be leaving, right? So, so by putting this in the bill, I mean, that still would be the case, right? We're just simply saying that if you know, if a person somehow walks away, that somebody should be notified. I would expect that probably the police would be called in this case. Wouldn't that usually be what would happen?
I hope we can end of Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, and I'll take a run at this, and then if the chief has other comments. Absolutely, you're correct. That's my expectation as well. I think this is more clarification language that if someone does walk away from the facility, that that would also be a reason to notify the submitting police agency. And so I think there may be an instance, and the chief could correct me if I'm wrong, but there might be an instance where a facility isn't in the jurisdiction of the submitting law enforcement agency. And so if someone walks away from a 72-hour hold and 911 is called, that doesn't necessarily mean that the original submitting law enforcement agency would have otherwise been notified during that scenario. I think this language clears that up.
Thank you.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you, Representative Zerwas, and thank you, Chief, for being here. So Representative Zerwas will renew his motion that House File 2803 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Members, the next bill will be Representative Halverson's bill, House File 2539. I hope I didn't catch you off guard there, Representative Halverson. I saw that you just walked in. Members, I will move that House File 2539 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us, and so Representative Halverson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate the time you're taking to hear about this small appropriation for a really big need in Minnesota. I'm working on this bill, which funds peer recovery specialists in Minnesota. The peer recovery support services, some of you may be familiar with this, these are non-clinical peer-run services that rebuild lives and reduce our health care costs ultimately by empowering individuals who are in recovery to stay sober and improve their lives, navigating through the very, very challenging world of rebuilding a life that has been stolen in many ways by addiction. Only about 10% of adults who need treatment for addiction actually get addiction services, which I find shocking. Peer recovery support services offers some individual guidance and some help during and after treatment. These support service providers embed themselves into communities and identify individuals who need assistance in turning their lives around. And these services and activities need to be flexible. So it means offering some non-traditional service hours and non-traditional locations. If this is passed, this grant funding will be available in all three of Minnesota's recovery community organizations, which are located in Rochester, Moorhead, and the Twin Cities metro area. Rigorous peer training and codes of ethics are anchors to these organizations. There's another appropriation in the bill which would allow the recovery community organizations to implement a public relations campaign to raise awareness and reduce stigmas that are associated very often with these addiction disorders. We know that stigma is a barrier to people seeking treatment, and reducing stigma around the disease of addiction, we can help enhance and increase access to recovery in Minnesota. I can not tell this story as well as the people who have come to Minnesota to testify. In fact, we had somebody come from Rochester today to testify. So, Madam Chair, if I start with you, I'd like to invite Chris Kelly and Paul Yerby to come down.
Absolutely. If you guys want to come forward, and if you could just introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony. And thanks for making the trip to the Capitol today.
Thank you. Hello,
I'm Chris Kelly. I'm a person in long-term recovery, and for me that means I haven't had a drink or a drug since April 27th of 2009. It also means that now I'm a very present mother, daughter, sister, friend. I pay my taxes. I own a home. I do lots of good things because a life of recovery was afforded to me. A lot of that has to do with peer support and finding a pathway to recovery that fit my lifestyle. At Minnesota Recovery Connection, we welcome all pathways to recovery. I'm the Director of Health and Wellness, and I oversee the peer services program, so meaning I oversee our peer recovery support specialists. I've had the opportunity to see lives turned around, from the lives of the people that we serve to volunteers that start with us, do some training, and then we actually have a workforce development track where they move up to different levels of training, go through our Recovery Coach Academy, and then they themselves are a peer recovery support specialist. This last year, we were able to work with Ramsey County, their detoxification center, and had peers embedded into the clinical staffing. At 3 months, 90 days after people had left the detox center, 75% hadn't returned. That was fantastic numbers for us. It was fantastic to see that working with a peer one-on-one made a difference to people. It reduced their emergency department visits. Our peers were able to work with them one-on-one so that they could get access to health care and actually go see a primary care physician, whether that meant the peer was helping them schedule the appointment, which can be a daunting task if having health insurance is new to you, to going with them and sitting with them in a waiting room, which also can be really nerve-wracking if that's not something that you're used to doing, helping guide them in what to talk about with that doctor. We've seen reduced costs as far as peers being embedded on clinical teams so that when they go to see the doctor, that conversation is really whittled down to that 15-minute window that you're often allotted when you show up in your doctor's office. I can't say enough about how important this work is. There is a waiver coming out that we're hoping that a bill like this would help create the funds necessary until peer recovery support specialists is a reimbursable position through Medicaid. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Paul Yerby, and it's an honor and a privilege to be here. I'm one of the peers, and I come here to tell some of the experiences that I've had with the peer support through Minnesota Recovery Connections. First, I want to say that when it came to the end of my treatment, I had asked my counselor, you know, for some information and some resources of some people that would be able to help me to continue in long-term recovery and to build me a positive and strong support network. And he gave me the telephone number to Minnesota Recovery Connections. He told me that, he said, when you call, he said, you know, if you're shy or if you're not ready to be in some one-on-one type of situations, they'll have someone there that you can talk to on the phone on a regular basis. Someone that you can call all the time if you need any type of help or any type of resources. And someone that will call you and check on you and make sure that everything is okay. And they was giving me a call every week to check on me and make sure that I was okay. And from the first few words of the conversation that we had, I realized that this wasn't just a job for them. It was a passion, a ministry, a mission that they was on. And it drew me. So they gave me a what we call a recovery coach. And when I first talked to my recovery coach and met her over the telephone, I got the same vibe. And it helped me to calm down and get a sense of trust where I was able to be able to talk about anything that was going on in my life. In the past, I wasn't able to do that. And that's a lot of that is reasons why I stayed in long-term addiction. So once we got comfortable with one another, again, she would call me every week. We would talk, you know, have really deep conversations about wisdom, and she would give me good advice. She invited me to this event that was called the Walk for Recovery. When I got to the event, this is when I first met her person to person, face to face. And when I first met her, I saw recovery at work in her and in her family. And not only did I see it in her and her family, I looked around the place, around the venue where we was, and I saw so many years of recovery. It had to be at least a million years of recovery in there. I saw so much restored life. It really gave me a whole lot of hope and a whole lot of inspiration that this thing does work. That was an event that I would, when it happens again, I'll be there again. Because again, I've never been in a situation or an event that was like that where I saw so many lives being restored. So the next situation that happened with them is there was a time where I was face to face with a situation that could have destroyed my recovery. And the first person who came to my mind was my recovery coach from Minnesota Recovery Connections, who's also one of my peers. It wasn't my pastor, it wasn't my mother, it wasn't my sponsor, it wasn't my girlfriend. That was the first person that came to mind because of the rapport and the trust that we had built, that I built with her. I called her, and she walked me through that situation, her and her husband. Walked me through the situation, gave me some sound wisdom and some sound advice that helped me to not only stay in recovery, but to get myself in a place, in a position away from high-risk situations. And so that helped me to be a whole lot more grateful for Minnesota Recovery Connections and the peer support that they offer. As a result of all of that, I ended up moving into my own place, maintaining gainful employment. I'm still in recovery, and it's growing better and better each and every day. We've ended up building a relationship where she's not only my recovery coach, but she's also a friend, like a big sister, a piece of the family that I've been longing for so many years. I wouldn't change it for nothing in the world. And there are a whole lot of people in the state of Minnesota alone, thousands of people that are just like me who need people like them. And I'm just hoping that you all are here with my heart is saying and give us some support to grow this thing. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much on behalf of the committee for being willing to share your stories and the road that you've been on to recovery. And so thank you for taking the time to be here and tell us that. Before we go to members' questions, I'll just say, is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for the bill or has any concerns? Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Tiffany Hunsley. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I run an organization called Recovery is Happening. I am the founder and executive director there, and I am also a woman in long-term recovery. And what that means to me is I have not used alcohol or drugs since July 28th of 2004. And because of that, my life is a whole lot better today. I get to be a sober mom today. I get to be a student, a teacher. I get to run an organization that strives to help others with peer support that saved my life. With Recovery is Happening, being in operation formally for a year and a half, we have had the opportunity to train 18 recovery coaches who are now working with matched peers in their recovery as they're coming out of prison treatment centers and halfway houses to take those barriers away that keep people going back to relapse time and time again. With our telephone recovery support service, we are reaching out in southeastern Minnesota at this time to 60 individuals who receive weekly phone calls to check in with them to see how their recovery is going and what we can do to help support them. Through these two operations, we have been able to save lives and reunify families. As we know, this is a growing epidemic, not only in our state, but in our nation. And we have to start treating addiction chronically and stop treating it acutely. I believe with the peer specialist model, it gives us an opportunity to look at that through a chronic care model where we're continuing to give people the support they need for a chronic condition for as long as they need. So thank you so much for allowing me to be here today.
Hi, my name's Phil Rutherford, and like the people before me, I'm also a man living in long-term recovery. What that means to me is that today I'm a better father, I'm a better husband, I'm a better employee, and a better community member, a registered taxpayer, or a registered voter, taxpayer. I like to say that, by the way, when I'm in a room full of people that are elected. I like to say that I'm a registered voter, and I know a lot of other registered voters. I'm just saying. I think, and everyone has spoken really well. I just want to, in the spirit of full disclosure, I am biased to peer support services. I've been blessed with the opportunity at Recovery is Happening to observe lives saved, families reunited, whole trajectories of people's lives changed as a result of recovery. And prior to doing this, I worked in the private sector, and one thing I was thinking about as we were talking today is bang for the buck. And you guys, again, elected folk, are in charge of using the public trust and distributing funds where they need to go. And from a bang for the buck perspective, peer support services are a very good investment. We were talking just before this, and the numbers, I believe you have a peer recovery document in your packet that has some kind of stats and figures. And I won't quote all of them, but the one that sticks out to me is that at 18 months of abstinence, a person, the odds are actually not all that good for a person in recovery. It's about 2 in 10. About 20% of people that achieve 18 months of abstinence stay abstinent for the rest of their lives. At 5 years, that number goes up to 80%. That's why peer support services matter, because what we do is we fill a gap, that 18-month to 5-year period. And it's not that we don't work with people in all phases of recovery, but that gap is not served. And since we know that we have a chronic illness, we believe that it's important to support people a little bit further than the traditional 30-day treatment, 60 days of aftercare. We are developing relationships with people in southeastern Minnesota. Probation officers typically refer people to us, and we've only been doing that for about 12 months, so it's hard to have full-on outcomes, but I can tell you that our outcomes are favorable, and they'll stand up to any other programs that are out there running. So for relatively little investment, we believe you get a lot. Not able to testify today, but we brought 8 people up here because this is important to our community. So thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. We do have a question from Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Representative Halverson for bringing this forward. This is a great bill, and I want to congratulate Phil and Tiffany and Paul on your sobriety. This is really good stuff, and you are in a program that helps. This is such a great, better chance for folks to stay sober for much longer, and it's the hardest thing to do, and I just want to say congratulations. You're the best looking folks that are walking. Is it a positive sign with addiction? And I just congratulate you on that, and it's a daily thing, so congratulations, and thank you again, Representative, for bringing this forward.
Members, any questions? Not seeing any. Representative Halverson, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I'll give you the final word on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly can't do anything, say anything more powerful than what we've heard from the testifiers, and I really appreciate everybody's consideration of this very important and, I believe, cost-effective legislation. So, thanks.
Thank you. Members, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2539 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Members, the next bill that we'll take up is House File 3150, Representative Whalen. Representative Whalen, welcome to the committee, and I will move that House File 3150 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. We have the bill in front of us, and Representative Whalen, I understand that there is a DE amendment.
There is, Madam Chair. And then a real quick question. with the referral to civil law, would it be referred to civil law or HHS finance? Is it?
Representative Whalen, civil law requested to see it, so it'll be going there next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair, members, thank you for having me here today to present the bill and moving the DE amendment. I had dropped the bill and then had a conversation with the Department of Health, who brought forward some great questions, and so we just wanted to clarify exactly what we were trying to do and the intent of the bill. So thank you to the department, who's also here, for their input. It was very helpful.
And Representative Whalen, why don't we, I'll move the DE3 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like, and then we can go on to discuss the bill from there, if that's okay with you.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, members, in order to get the bill in the order the author would like, I will move the DE3 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Okay, Representative Whalen, to your bill as amended.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll say thank you again to the department for their input. This is a very simple bill. It just seeks to ensure that our reporting requirements are keeping up with technology. When the legislature originally wrote the statutes for the requirements of physicians and facilities performing abortions in 1998, I think it's safe to say that telemedicine probably wasn't on most folks' radar. And this bill just seeks to address that. It simply adds one reporting requirement to the current form used by these physicians and abortion facilities. The current form requires that the facility code be reported. This bill adds, if you look at line 2.21 to 2.22, that the form include, quote, the facility code for the patient and the facility code for the physician, if that's different than the patient. So, I also, just as full disclosure to the committee, recently learned there may be a cost to the bill. I didn't anticipate, based on the antiquated system the department has for inputting data. So I can't imagine it being a very high cost due to the number of abortions done via telemedicine are just a subset of all abortions. So the forms, it would not be all the forms. It would just be those that are within this subset. So with that, Madam Chair, members, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Representative Whalen. And we do have some testifiers on the list, so I'll have them come forward, and then we will go to member questions. And so, okay, so first I have Ms. Rao. Okay, excuse me. We actually have Andrea Ledger, who's interested in testifying, if you want to come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
If you could introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Ledger. I'm the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today about this bill. I'm in opposition to this bill, which we think is both unnecessary and biased against a single type of health care provider. Abortion is an extremely safe procedure. That's demonstrated by the very report that we are talking about here, which in 2014 found only a 0.008% complication rate, either intraoperative or postoperative. Further, the use of telemedicine for abortion has also been proven safe. A study of Iowa patients found that 600 women utilizing abortion via telemedicine had comparable clinical outcomes to those who saw a doctor in person. A second study conducted during a two-year period, both before and after the enactment of Iowa's law, found that women were more likely to obtain an abortion earlier when the procedure is both less risky and less costly. Those women who utilized telemedicine were also more likely to report satisfaction with the procedure. Medication abortion in and of itself is both safe and effective. The number of adverse events associated with the medication used for medical abortion is less, for example, than for Tylenol or Viagra. And telemedicine is becoming a more common practice. Many fields of medicine, including cardiology, pediatrics, dentistry, and psychiatry, are using it to deliver health services. This type of care also holds promise for reproductive health services. The system of telemedicine is especially important for reaching Americans who live in remote or rural areas and do not have access to a nearby doctor. About one-fourth of Americans live in rural areas, while only 10% of physicians practice in these areas. 95% of Minnesota counties have no abortion provider. It's extremely difficult for some women to travel to a reproductive health clinic when they can access abortion services directly from a provider. The report on induced abortions in Minnesota is already a really lengthy and comprehensive document. The 2015 report of 2014 data came in at 53 pages and included, but wasn't limited to, demographic data of women seeking abortions, type of procedure performed, the reason for the abortion, and complication rates. The bill before you today does nothing to protect women's health. Instead, it lays groundwork to create additional barriers for women and their doctors. I appreciate your time, and I would take any questions.
And I just have a brief question. Just doing a fair amount of work on telemedicine over the last couple of years. I'm just curious into just to your comment about, making a requirement for this procedure versus others. My understanding in conversations with the department and working on this issue is that there's a great deal of interest in tracking to the extent of which telemedicine is being used. Just for one, it's further development going forward and quality management. And so it's my understanding that there is a great deal of reporting being expanded across the medical spectrum on the use of telemedicine. And so is that not the impression that your organization has? I'm just looking for clarification, because to me this brings it in line with quite a few procedures that are being done, trying to understand how telemedicine is impacting procedures across the state. So just clarification on that point.
Sure, Madam Chair. Thanks for the question. I think, as you know, that this is a growing and developing field of medicine right now. I am not aware of other procedures right now that are reported in this same way, and to the extent that abortion is already reported in the state of Minnesota. So you may be correct that in the future that kind of reporting will be necessary, but I'm not aware of any current requirements.
We have a question from Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Ledger. A couple questions. First of all, and maybe I'm wrong, but wasn't there a similar law that was overturned by the Iowa court? And second question, I'm very concerned about the privacy issue here, and I know that's going to civil law, but I also have to vote on the thing. And so do you have any, even though it's going to civil law, since I'm voting on it, do you have any views on, I'm concerned a lot about privacy here.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, to your first question, there was actually a ban on telemedicine that was passed in Iowa, and that was ruled unconstitutional by the Iowa Supreme Court. To your second question regarding privacy, I think that's an extremely valid concern, particularly in that the way that the reporting is described in this legislation, it would single out providers and identify the ones particularly that are providing telemedicine. And so I think that it would put both patients and doctors' privacy at risk.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a similar concern about whether or not this could be used to identify the woman undergoing the procedure, because already we're collecting information on age, the economic reasons, which might mean I was laid off. It could be something that would be an identifier as well. You have your payers, so you know whether or not they have, coverage under an employer, or you get, some of those sorts of things. And then you put the location, and, there may only be one doctor in a big geographic area, because we do have a real shortage of physicians in a lot of parts of the state, and we've actually been offered up telemedicine as a way to help meet that shortage, and I'm really worrying if this might actually discourage people from doing that, if it means more reporting, more things for people who are just providing the care that a geographic area needs because of scarcity via telemedicine. But I am concerned that the combination of things that we already collect plus the location we have counties with less than 5,000 people. It's kind of like my neighborhoods. People know each other. They know their circumstances. They know what's going on in a lot of times in people's lives. And so because of that, I'm concerned about the combination here
and whether or not this might have actually a chilling effect on what we have been promoting, which is telemedicine. And I don't understand why we need the facility code for the patient in any reason, and if perhaps the author could address why she thinks it's important to know where the patient is.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to address a few of the points that have been brought up so far, to Representative Mueller's point, the Iowa issue, this bill is not what Iowa did. This is simply adding one question on the reporting form, which I have here. It's just very simple form, could add a little box. If the abortion was performed via telemedicine, the facility code for the patient. And then as to the concerns regarding privacy, we already require, so if you are getting an abortion performed in the same facility that the physician is in, which is most, that information is already accessible and available. So this doesn't really expand or change any of the privacy issues in my view or my understanding. And then I'll just reiterate Chair Mack's point as well, that the field of telemedicine is a very new growing industry, and we're just trying to keep up with the technology and looking at ways that telemedicine may or may not be impacting, benefiting people, especially in rural Minnesota.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Whalen, I still don't understand. I didn't hear there a reason why we needed to know where the patient was. We already have information, as you said, about who is authorizing this procedure or conducting this procedure. What is the reason for knowing the location of the woman and further identifying potentially her, particularly in scarce rural areas?
Representative Whalen.
So the bill, line 2.21 to 2.22, if the abortion was performed via telemedicine, the facility code for the patient and the facility code for the physician, you know, I would be open to potentially amending and just saying if the abortion was performed via telemedicine, the facility code for the physician, and then, you know, if the department is here and wants to offer any input as well, like I said, I had worked with them on clarifying the language so that because that was part of the department's concern as well, the way the bill was originally drafted, if it would lead to, you know, potentially finding the address of the patient, which is not our intent at all. We don't want necessarily to have any invasion of privacy for patients. Certainly not our intent.
But Madam Chair, my last question is sort of the other half of that is, which is, why do we need the facility code for the physician rather than just knowledge of whether or not it was performed by a telemedicine? Why is the location important? We tend to collect in state agencies tons of data that really have no useful life, and it seems to me just knowing if your interest is just to know how much of this is done by telemedicine, then we shouldn't also have to identify the facility or the provider either.
Representative Whalen, and I'll have you answer that, but if you could include in your comments, because what I understood you to say earlier was we track this same information for people who have abortions done through non-telemedicine means. So my understanding, and if there was somebody from the department who could speak to it just to clarify, it probably would be helpful for the sake of the committee. But my understanding is that's not new from anybody else who's getting an abortion.
Correct.
But Representative Whalen, if you could comment on that.
Yeah. No, thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct. We already require on the report the physician reporting code and the facility reporting code. And so if the abortion is performed via telemedicine, to understand that specifically, we would just say the facility reporting code for that facility as well, and that would just make it very clear, and it's a very clear, easy way for us to report that on the form.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you know, maybe staff or the bill author could help me understand. Looking at this, 218, you obviously are looking at complications, you're collecting data, and you know, from a scientific background, I always thought it was nice to understand if there are interactions, especially with telemedicine, between a site and another site, because there could be technical issues, there could be other circumstances so that you would better understand and improve delivery of service if you actually knew that, well, they don't have the broadband connection, there are other issues. I don't see any data that requests a name, so I'm confused about the personal identification concerns when, you know, they already are collecting, you know, who the physician is, how many abortions are performed. So the only thing that this adds, to my understanding, is a technical perspective of what the interaction of site to site, which telemedicine is, would have on complications versus, you know, at site. And so maybe there's something I'm missing, but to me, I see nothing other than assistive understanding of the interaction of telemedicine with delivery of this medical service. And I see nothing that says, you know, identify the person. So maybe staff or the office could tell me, you know, why I'm missing this line of questioning that has been going on.
Okay, Representative, I don't see anybody clear. Is there somebody you want to directly ask that question to, or?
No, if nobody else seems to understand why you would go off on that tangent for, you know, a reasonable addition of data, then I'm fine with that.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Whalen. Could you just kind of talk through a little bit about what kinds of information the department currently collects for reporting, where they report it, how they report that, and why?
Sure, Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dean. So the bill itself, if you look, that it gives a lot of the information that's currently must be reported, including the method used for the abortion, the approximate gestational age expressed, the age of the woman at the time the abortion was performed, the specific reason for the abortion, whether or not an infant was born alive as a result of a failed abortion, and other reasons. And the form, like I said right here, we collect all of this information for various reasons, and including, as Representative Quam alluded to, potential complications. We want to understand and make sure the health of the mother and is first and foremost our priority. And so we definitely want to make sure that we're prioritizing the mom and all of this. And this is one of the ways that we do that.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Chair Mack and Representative Will. Do we currently find out where the person lives or where the abortion was performed?
Representative Whalen.
Currently on the form, the report of induced abortion, that the physician abortion facility has, and that they submit then to the Department of Health, it does request have the patient residence, the patient birthday, and I'm happy to pass the form around if people want to see it as well.
Yeah, that might be helpful if you want to have just a page, just pass that around, because I doubt most members have probably seen that or just know what we currently ask. And I think that makes a lot of sense to find that out and also to report it from the department. And I think most folks would prefer that abortions are rare, and that we would want to look into the situations around that to make sure that that certain areas of the state aren't more impacted by that than others, or certain age groups, for example, as a reflection of health risk and disparity. So that there's a reason that we currently do this, and those are some of the reasons that we do that. And in fact, as we look at the emergence of telemedicine, one of the things that we are really wrestling with is that there's two ends. There's a physician at one end, and that there's a patient at another end, and there's often another physician at the patient end, and there's nurses and staff and support people. And we have to look at both sides of that equation, and we're currently wrestling around with how you pay for that at one end versus the other or both. And also on reporting, realizing that people get and receive services at different places. So I guess I would say that this is really a reflection and an acknowledgement of where we are headed with further reporting along telemedicine, and really looks more along the lines of where we're headed than perhaps something new or something that should be opposed. So I thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Whalen.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to help Representative Crum maybe understand what he's missing and maybe what some of the rest of the committee is missing. And I think that, first of all, you know, we all have in front of us the current law in the on the form and on the DE amendment, kind of what all the requirements are for reporting around abortion. And I had a copy of the report on my desk, which I forgot to bring down to committee with me, but Ms. Ledger did note that the complication rate is extremely low, lower than for many, many other things. I don't think there's any medical procedure for which we require anything near this kind of reporting. So, for some of us, this is, you know, the very fact that we require all this information is to single out this particular aspect of women's health care for separate, special kind of treatment. And for a lot of us, the fact that we do this already is really excessive. So that's number one. Secondly, in fact, I was going to ask Representative Mack, since I know she carried legislation on telemedicine, where we require this kind of detailed reporting in other procedures. I doubt very much that we do. And if we do, we ought to include this where in the same place in other legislation. If it's required for other medical proceedings, then it would include this too, and we would not need this bill. We would not need to add it here. So again, the fact that this is being added is again singling out women's reproductive services, a woman's constitutional right to have an abortion, and singling it out for one more, you know, going after that right. That's how it feels to a lot of us, Representative Quam. So I think that is what you're missing. And the concern about privacy, you know, I think the concern about privacy, the specific concern is that if there's this reporting by facility, that it might be possible for someone to find out in a place where there's really like maybe only one abortion performed and it's performed by telemedicine, that that might allow somebody to find out that a particular woman had an abortion. That's the concern there. And maybe we're a little hypersensitive about that, but this whole thing, this whole law is all about trying to make it that much more intrusive and harder and singling out women's right to have abortions. And that, Representative Quam, is what you've been missing.
Members, we don't have any other questions right now. Oh, okay. And I'll just briefly say, Representative Liebling, to, I don't know if it was a rhetorical or direct question to me.
I'd love to know the answer.
But I have sent a brief text, but I'm not seeing the person, hoping that there would maybe be somebody who could answer from the department, because I remember us talking about reporting so that whether it's from the plan's perspective or providers for quality management of telemedicine and to get an idea of how expansive telemedicine was growing over time. So I'd be happy to follow up with you. We talked about it. I want to say that we included it, whether it was in my bill or another bill, but I'd truly have to follow up with you because I don't know off the top of my head and couldn't get the answer I was hoping for. But it's been discussed whether or not we've passed anything. I would have to follow up with
one. Representative Mack.
Representative Liebling.
So if we pass something that, if we're genuinely interested in telemedicine as a new phenomenon, which I think is fine, we should be interested in that, and we're collecting data around that, then we don't need this. We just don't need it at all. And if we don't have it in other places, then we shouldn't be doing this because it's, again, singling out women's private reproductive services. So either way, I don't think we need this bill, and I'm going to oppose it. And I certainly think that we shouldn't even be doing this in this very short year when we have so little time to take care of the business that needs to be taken care of.
Representative Mazin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I guess I really am concerned about personal data that is getting to be expected regardless of whatever you fill out. So I'm very, very cautious. And when we're talking about filling out a form, I can see a whole lot of stuff on here that I think really is nobody's business should be on this form in the first place. So I would think you would do a better service by eliminating half of the stuff on here rather than adding this. And when you're talking whether it's education, healthcare, the paperwork is getting to be ridiculous. We need to learn to be concise and get the information we absolutely need. So my personal opinion. Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. pardon me for being a little late. I had another meeting in my office, but, you know, so as I look at this document, and now it's clear to me that this is something that was put into law in 1998. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct,
okay,
Representative.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And so I agree. This is like a total overreach of government. I don't know where we were in 1998 that we felt that we needed to collect all this information on a woman that is really, really private. You know, the pregnancy was a result of race or incest or the woman's emotional health is at stake, the woman's physical health. The pregnancy resulted in fetal abnormalities, and I mean, this is like really, really private information of a woman's. And I just think this is, I don't know where we were in 1998, but I just think this is like a total overreach of government.
Okay, members, I don't see any other questions from members. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking at, I don't know what the form says, because the form doesn't really mean what has to be reported. And the statute doesn't say anything about identifying the woman's address or anything like that. So I assume that the woman doesn't have to be identified since the law doesn't say so.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Oh, excuse me. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to request a roll call.
A roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. Members, any other questions? Representative Whalen, I'll give you the final word on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few comments. So regarding current law and the reporting requirements being the comment was made maybe excessive. If we are comparing abortion procedures and facilities to other surgical centers, other medical procedures, I would say abortion does have a special carve-out in that they're not licensed or regulated as every other medical procedure and hospital and clinic in the state is. And so when we look at the requirements for reporting, it is one of the very few ways we have to ensure the safety of the mother is being prioritized. In fact, it does not go far enough. We should be regulating and licensing all of these clinics to ensure the safety of the mother. And to the specific concern on privacy, I would like to point out again the bill will be going to civil law, and we can fully vet those questions, and I'm happy to work with members on ensuring privacy rights of individuals. And again, thank you for hearing the bill with that. I'll ask you to pass the bill along to civil law. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. Members, there has been a roll call requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Mack?
Aye.
Representative Mallory?
No.
Representative Albright?
Aye.
Representative Allen?
No.
Representative Backer?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Aye.
Representative Dean?
Yep.
Representative Fisher?
No.
Representative Franzen?
Aye.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Kelly?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Loeffler?
No.
Representative Lohmer?
Yes.
Representative Mason?
No.
Representative Moran?
No.
Representative Pearson?
Yes.
Representative Quam?
C.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Schultz?
Aye.
No. Representative Zerwas.
Aye.
Members, there being 12 ayes and 9 nays, the motion prevails. And the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Thank you, Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, the next bill of the day will be House File 2405. Representative Zerwas.
You got one or two? Or three or four?
Representative Zerwas moves that House File 2405 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us, and I don't see any amendments, so Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2405 seeks to change Minnesota law by seeking a federal waiver to allow low and moderate income individuals who apply for health plan through MnSure to have the right to choose between the basic health plan or a qualified health plan. And if choosing the qualified health plan, using the premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. So right now, low and moderate income Minnesotans don't have the same rights as to choose a qualified health plan as all other Minnesotans who apply for health plan through MnSure. And that is, right now, once your income and eligibility is determined and you've been deemed eligible or qualified for the basic health plan, it is mandatory, if you go through MnSure, to be put into the basic health plan for individuals. Otherwise, you can't qualify for the advanced premium tax credits and cost sharing. It's still by through the private market. And so under current law, low and moderate income individuals are denied the right to choose the health plan that they may believe best meets their needs. If they want to help paying for their insurance premiums, for members' respect or reference, this applies to individuals whose income currently is between 138% and 200% of the federal poverty guideline. The fact that MnSure automatically enrolls individuals that fall within there into the BHP, once the MnSure has made that determination and put you in the bucket, you cannot get back out and try to go into the qualified health plan market for a private policy insurance and still get the premiums that in 49 other states you could use your premium incentives through the Affordable Care Act to pay down your private insurance. But in Minnesota, because of our BHP, you don't have that option. So that can be a real barrier to folks, as that BHP plan comes with a lot of limitations for coverage. And I know, Madam Chair, that we have some testifiers on the bill, and we can have some testifiers, and then we can take some questions.
Sounds good. Welcome to the committee. If you want to come forward, introduce yourself, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas. My name is Chris Schneeman. I own an independent employee benefit insurance agency here in St. Paul. I'm also a legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters and represent the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform, which is an organization comprised of the four largest professional insurance agent associations in Minnesota, collectively representing over 50,000 licensed agents and their employees. As agents, we provide service to both group and the individual health insurance consumer every day, and help them with their health insurance purchasing decisions. Health insurance agents support this bill because we support a person's right to choose a plan that is best suited to them. Under the Minnesota rules currently being applied, any person who reports less than the 200% federal poverty level is forced into MennCare or onto medical assistance if their income is below 138%. Some people think that this is a good thing and that MennSure knows best, but we think MennSure was supposed to be a marketplace that encouraged competition and choice. So why do we need this choice? Because many Minnesotans simply do not want to be on public assistance, and as we're well aware, many folks have assets and don't want to be forced into a position that there'll be a lien against their property. Many Minnesotans want to have the full ability to choose their providers and not be assigned a managed care organization. In fact, some Minnesotans want to have Mayo as a network option for them. Many of these people want their doctor to be paid fair commercial insurance reimbursement rates and don't want to feel that their doctor is sacrificing because she only gets paid at that medical assistance reimbursement rate. They also don't want to find out that it might become hard to get an appointment with their doctor because of that reimbursement rate. Many people wanted to keep their coverage as had been promised to them before. Until this year, Minnesota was the only state to restrict a person's right to these federal tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. We think this is unfair. I can provide testimony, I'm providing this testimony not to disassemble the Minnesota Care program, because of many of these public programs like Minnesota Care can be excellent solutions, but we think it's wrong to eliminate all other reliable options and force people into a single solution. Last, I'll read excerpts from an email that was dated on March 13, 2014, from an agent who relays frustration exhibited by his client, Chuck. Chuck had tried to purchase a policy on MennSure and ended up against his wishes on medical assistance. Chuck is over 55. And at that time, 2014, he knew that medical assistance was not for him. The quote is, "I just got off the phone with Raylene at DHS Help Desk, who tells me that no one can disenroll anyone who has been auto-enrolled on medical assistance via MennSure." Chuck persists, and later on he learns, in quotes again, "the person in charge of medical assistance at the county doesn't know anything about estate recovery liens and thinks that she can get his medical assistance canceled." Chuck's solution then was to go outside of MennSure completely, secure his own private health insurance, and did not receive any assistance via advanced premium tax credits or cost sharing reductions. Any other state, he would have access to those cost sharing reductions and APTCs. So please support this bill. Honest people are being misled and they're forced into plans that they don't want. Thank you.
Members, are there, if you want to stay close by, if there's any questions, but we will see if there's any other testifiers who want to support the bill or have concerns about the bill. Not seeing anyone. Representative Zerwas.
You know, and I think as we really dig in to some of the issues and concerns that come out of digging into what happens when you go to enroll in MennSure, you think you're in a private marketplace, you think you're buying insurance. We have example after example of families being split where, in many cases, really, dependents are auto-enrolled into a BHP, even though their parents won't qualify for the basic health plan. So the parents will qualify for a qualified health plan, but then the dependents will be auto-enrolled into a BHP. So that means you and your child may have totally different networks. You have to see different doctors, have to go to different hospitals. And those are huge issues and huge concerns for families that make this really arduous and really stressful. And then the other thing is we've seen in Chair Dean's committee about the low number that's being collected through the 3.5% withhold, and how that could have dire implications for the fund balance moving forward of MennSure. And just to remind everyone, every single policy, and every single person that's automatically enrolled in the BHP and can't use that tax credit to buy a private plan like you can in 49 other states. Those individuals, that 3.5% premium withhold that's supposed to pay for MnSure, that's not collected in those instances. And so that doesn't go in to the pie. And so I think those are all concerns for why what seemed perhaps to some as a well-intentioned approach has really caused a lot of confusion and some heartache for Minnesotans.
Okay, question from Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And on the administrative costs of MnSure, which I know is not your major focus of this bill, every policy that comes from MnSure pays its share. We have that in state law, that if you get on a public program, whether it's Minnesota Care MA, they pay their share of the administrative costs. If it's a QHP private insurance, it pays it through the 3.5%. And so it's not like there isn't, you know, there is administrative costs for running MnSure paid with each policy, and that's structurally designed, and we actually had a hearing on that earlier. But my bigger concern is, you know, Representative Ross, we have heard and we know there have been real challenges trying to get all the computer systems related to this working effectively. And we've heard from counties and from others about the need to prioritize what work needs yet to be done. I've heard from tons of people who are absolutely delighted that they got qualified and were surprised that qualified for Minnesota Care or MA because it was so much more affordable than they ever thought. And some people who are taking their medications full strength now that we're cutting them in half just because the prescriptions were too expensive. And with Minnesota Care, they have more access to affordable prescription filling. But, you know, there may be people on both sides. But the question I have is if we are in a situation where we still have to triage and prioritize our computer investments. Why should this one, which I assume will have a fiscal note connected to doing that sort of thing, rise to the top over the ones that we have heard from the counties that, and others that really affect thousands of cases across the state rather than, I think, a much more limited number here?
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I'm starting to believe that there are members that are getting emails and regaled with these amazing MnSure success stories that folks on my side of the aisle just, we're not getting those emails. We're not getting those stories of success after success after success. I get email after email after email that says, I got stuck on a public program, and I don't know how. And MnSure can't tell me how. And I want to get off. And they can't help me get off the program. Those are the stories that we're hearing. So we're just not getting berated with those success stories. And as far as, you know, where this should qualify, as far as the big IT punch list, that's yet to be completed. I've had several bills dealing with MnSure and MA around eligibility verification, enrollment verification. And in some instances, I've been told by Minute and DHS that I couldn't even offer a bill to Chairman Dean's committee because I couldn't possibly get a fiscal note within 36 months. To me, I believe that is an example of the administration stopping the legislative process and stopping the discussion. Now, we've since done a hard negotiation and got that down to, I think, 16 months so that I'm able to get a fiscal note and able to move forward. I'm not going to argue that the MnSure computer system isn't wholly and completely broken. But I think we need to understand that at some point, what was done years ago and forced a segment of Minnesotans into this program with no options to buy something in the private market. You make between this and this. Congratulations. You have no option to shop anywhere else. And by shop, I mean you get this. Do you want it? tough luck. You get it. You get it. We're the only state in the nation that has done that to their state residents that are between 138 and 200%. And I've heard from so many of my constituents that say, why can't we have access to those tax credits to buy up a level on our insurance plan and buy a private insurance policy like every other Minnesotan can? It's a bill about basic freedom.
Representative Loeffler.
I would just say that I also think that we stand out in another way, and that my understanding is that we are the second lowest rate of uninsured in the nation. The only state that beats us is Massachusetts, which formed an exchange before us. We've cut our rate of uninsurance in half, which has really made a dramatic difference in the uncompensated care of our healthcare provider system. And so I think we really have to look at, you know, the trade-offs of various approaches, but I do think that we need to weigh that, because it has been successful in reducing the amount of uninsured people and uncompensated care, and part of that has been through giving people a gateway that gets them to affordable coverage.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
I would point out that we were the lowest prior to MnSure, and we had the lowest premiums prior to MnSure. So I think we could go on and on about the validity of all that, but I think the reality is, it is very hard for anyone on this committee to talk to a constituent and say, we never have insurance rates, uninsured rates that are down here, when we're talking to a person that is saying, I don't want to be forced into this. I want to be able to choose my doctor. Right now, some of my constituents that live in Otsego, which is in Wright County, if they get put into the BHP, Representative Loeffler, they can't go across the river into Elk River to their clinic, which is 2 miles away, because that goes to a different county. So they have to go 25 minutes away to Buffalo for a new doctor in a new clinic, in a new health system, because their MCO has to be within their county of residence. We're talking about basic choice and basic freedom. We are the one state in the entire nation that has said, only because your income is this, this is your one policy, this is your one shot, you better love it, because if you don't love it, you get nothing. Why? Why would we do that to Minnesotans?
Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler.
I wish we'd ever been number one in uninsured rate, but I look forward to being corrected if that ever did happen. But I do think we also need to remember the vast majority of people are covered by private employers, and most of the people that I know in private employer coverage don't have choice of networks either. For better or for worse, that is the way the insurance market has gone over the last 20 years. I know people who can't go to the doctor six blocks from them that they had a relationship with and haven't been able to get back to for 15 years because their employer has never once again contracted with a plan that included that. So, I mean, I think the trade-offs that you're talking about are endemic to a system of insurance that really is based on networks, and networks always limit choice, but they also tend to...
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
And just briefly, I don't know of any private plan that limits networks by the county you live in. There might be a geographical area, or there might be a health network system, but the idea that you have to go to the doctor in the county you live in, that is unique to this BHP process. And I would say that if you had a private insurance policy, you do have a choice in that you can buy through the exchange. So I think what we have here is we have the only group that is forced this scenario, is forced onto it only because they're low income. And they get no choice. And I think that's wrong. In 49 other states, low-income residents get a choice. They get to take their tax credits, and they get to apply it to the private market. I don't see why we wouldn't allow that here.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there's a lot to cover here, Representative Zerwas, and the last thing you said kind of reminds me that in a whole bunch of states, people have no choice to get any insurance because those Republican governors refuse to expand Medicaid. And so those people who are below, it was the ACA was never designed for that. As you know, it was the Supreme Court that changed it. And so some people in some of those Republican states have no choice at all to get on health care, and those are the poor people. But that's kind of an aside. I really wanted to say that, you know, I think you're onto something here. I think there's, you know, I'm not opposed to what you're talking about in a sense. And I think it would be great if we gave people more choice. I actually think there would be very few people who would opt out of Minnesota Care to go to a QHP because they're a lot more expensive, a lot more out-of-pocket costs. But there might be some isolated cases where that might be a choice for somebody for some of the reasons that you've mentioned. I think it was the testifier who said something about the estate recovery issue, and I think that that only applies in medical assistance, not Minnesota Care. So that would not be a reason. Right? So that probably is a misspeak. You know, I think there are a few things. You know, there's a bill that came out of the healthcare task force to raise the eligibility for Minnesota Care up to 275% of poverty. And since you're interested in choice, I wonder if you'd be interested in that. If a person could, you know, I think it would be great if we could program the computers, and it might be a heavy lift, and we might take us some to get there. But allowing people to have a choice to be on Minnesota Care, I think the direction would be much more that way than the other way, just because of the economics of, in fact, I think it would be great if the entire state could choose to be on Minnesota Care. I think you'd get a lot of buy-in there because, in fact, it's really, in a lot of ways, a better program than a lot of what you can get on a QHP. So there's that. But, you know, I think that the network thing is you know, all of the QHPs have networks, as far as I understand. And one of the complaints consumers are making is that private insurance plans have very narrow networks, and that's how they're holding down costs. So this idea that anybody gets full and free choice, you know, it's just kind of what your trade-offs are. Nobody gets complete choice of, you know, within plans. The other thing is that within Minnesota Care, you do have choice within Minnesota Care. You get a choice of HMO. You pick your HMO, and I frankly think that, you know, I think people want choices of providers, not choices of plans. You know, if it really came down to it, how many people really like shopping for insurance? It's a real necessary evil. You know, I don't think it's a terrible thing to say that you don't have to be on a public program if you don't want to be. You can get your insurance another way. I'm fine with that, actually. I just don't think you'll have many takers. And by the way, we tried this before. We did that so-called Healthy Minnesota program. Remember that? Were you here?
Probably not.
That was Representative Gottwald's baby when he was the chair of this committee. And took the higher-income people who were on Minnesota Care and said, we're going to give you some amount of money, and this was before the ACA. We gave them some amount of money and said, go on the private market and buy a plan. And his idea was the private market will serve them better and all of that. And if I remember right, the uptake for that was really, really small. And a lot of people just went without insurance. And I don't know, maybe somebody from the Department of Health could come and tell us a little more about that. But I guess what I'm saying to you is I don't mind the idea of choice. I just don't think it's a really big issue for most people. But it might be an issue for a few people. And I'm okay to give people choice if they want to do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
You heard it here first. Zerwas labeling, health referendum, taking the world by storm. You had me all the way up to single payer. And I was like, whoa, hey.
So, Madam Chair.
Whoa, hey, whoa. No, Madam Chair, obviously there's going to be components that we're going to not agree on in the scope of this. I think it's worth exploring. I think it's worth continuing the conversation. And I think I have an issue when we say that the big determination is going to be that income piece. And once you get locked in to that income piece, from what we've heard from the counties and all down the line, is there's just no getting out of that without going to no insurance or buying insurance through the private market without any type of tax assistance that you would get in many other states.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
So, Representative Zerwas, then, are you in favor of expanding eligibility to 275 so those people can get a choice? And what about to everybody?
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
What I said, just short of single payer, I meant quite a bit short of single payer.
So,
275? It's not an auction.
Representative Dean.
I just request a roll call.
Okay. Roll call being requested by Representative Dean. Member, are there other questions or comments? Okay. I am not seeing any. So, Representative Zerwas, final word on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a pretty clear and cut issue. We've certainly talked about it enough.
Okay, members, a roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Mack?
Yes.
Representative Mullery?
Yes.
Representative Albright?
Yes.
Representative Allen?
Yes.
Representative Backer?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Yes.
Representative Dean?
Yep.
Representative Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Franson?
Aye, but I have to pay my seat properly.
Aye. Representative Freiberg? Representative Kelly?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes, so the fiscal no.
Representative Lohmer?
Yes.
Representative Mason?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Pearson?
Yes.
Representative Quam? Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Representative Zerwas?
Yes.
Members, there being 19 ayes and 0 noes, the motion prevails and the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Members, the next bill of the day is going to be House File 3276, which is my bill, and so I will briefly hand the gavel over to Representative Albright.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3276 and have it re-referred to the General Register.
Representative Mack, do you wish to move the A1 amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair, and it's just a technical amendment.
Is there any discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Mack, to your bill as amended.
Thank
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, the bill in front of you is a follow-up to a bill that we passed last year that I carried dealing with community-directed services and supports. And due to some unanticipated lack of activity by the federal government, this bill is just taking steps and is a technical bill to make sure that we can move forward with what we intended last year. And so in order to give it a little bit more detail for members, I will turn it over to Mr. Larson to shed light on exactly what we're doing here and why it's needed.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could just name say your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota. And as Representative Mack said, this bill allows the continuation of a 20% increase in the consumer-directed community supports budget for high school graduates that are on this particular waiver program. This allows them to seek employment and get additional support and not have to go to some of our more formal programs. The legislation that Representative Mack referred to was included in the Health and Human Services omnibus bill. Expanded this option not only to high school graduates but for other individuals that would either be on consumer-directed community supports or would wish to go back to that option, and that requires CMS approval. We haven't received that yet and doesn't look like we will for several months, so we want to maintain the existing option of a 20% budget increase for high schoolers that want to seek employment.
Is there any comment from anyone in the audience to this bill as amended? Seeing none, any final comments from or questions from the committee? Seeing none, any final comments to your bill as amended, Chair Mack?
I think we're set, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mack renews her motion that House File 3276 as amended be recommended and be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails and House File 3276 as amended is re-referred to the General Register.
You know what? You got a good point.
Okay, members, we are with just 10 minutes remaining. I don't think we'll be able to conclude any of the bills that we have left at this time, so we will recess at this time until 6:45, where we will continue with our agenda. We'll be back in this room. If you want to, whatever information bills you want to make sure to have at 6:45, just make sure they're back in your folder. Anything out on the table will be cleared and thrown. So with that, members, we will see you back here at 6:45, and we are in recess. Members, we will reconvene the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. And we right now are going to have Representative Dean present one of Representative Zerwas's bill on Representative Zerwas's behalf, as he has currently tied up presenting a bill in a different committee and will get here as quickly as he can. And so, Representative Dean, what bill would you like me to move? I can't. I apologize, members. We've just been trying to figure out which order we should go in. So, Representative Dean, what's been
you
have
Chair.
In front of you?
Madam Chair, House File 3277.
Okay, members, I will move that House File 3277. Just give me 1 minute as I see where it's going. I will move that House File 3277 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And Representative Dean, to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3277 is Representative Zerwas' bill on food stamp employment and training program reimbursement. And for this bill, I have Sarah Strong to introduce the bill and also to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. And just to get the bill in the author in the order that the author needs it. There is an A1 amendment, members, in your packet. And so I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no.
Nay.
The motion prevails. Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony on the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, good evening. My name is Sarah Strong-Belisle with Cook Gerard Associates, and I'm here today on behalf of MSP WIN, a philanthropic collaborative comprised of 14 workforce program funders. As funders of workforce training programs, we have a keen interest in ensuring Minnesota's SNAP employment and training program is robust and effective. Currently, we have a disconnect in our economy. Minnesota employers increasingly report a shortage of skilled workers, while increased skill requirements leave many potential workers unable to secure the training they need to compete for jobs. The SNAP E&T program serves some of our lowest skilled workers and thus is well positioned to help shrink the skills gap. But Minnesota is leaving millions of federal dollars on the table that could benefit job seekers and employers alike. House File 3277 does two things. First, it cancels the fiscal year 2017 transfer of $4.4 million in federal USDA 50-50 reimbursement dollars to the general fund and requires these reimbursement funds to be used for their intended purpose to supplement Minnesota's investments in education and training for SNAP participants. Sending this money to the general fund does not help participants or the local partners working hard to serve them. We are pleased to see the governor recognize this and include this recommendation in his supplemental budget last week. Second, the bill instructs DHS to work to capture Minnesota's fair share of additional 50-50 reimbursement dollars and ensures that money will go back to the organizations that incurred the training costs so it can be reinvested in skills training for SNAP participants. This federal reimbursement option is flexible, uncapped, and can be applied to third-party investments. This is a potentially significant funding resource that Minnesota is not taking full advantage of. No new state money would be required to leverage additional federal dollars. Training investments are already being made across the state by counties, colleges, community-based organizations, and many others. Minnesota is well positioned to improve our SNAP E&T program investments by capitalizing on the dollars already being spent. If you take a look at the handout in your packets, you'll see a chart that shows how Minnesota compares to three other states as far as this 50-50 funding based on their 2015 state plans. And I think you'll agree that there's no doubt there's room for improvement in the program. We believe passing this bill is a step in the right direction. We hope you'll support it, and we hope that you'll help us make progress towards building an effective, job-driven SNAP and employment training program. Thank you, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you so much for being here. And I understand we have one other testifier on the list, and so why don't we have you come forward, and then if you want to stick around if there's any questions, that would be great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Great. Thank you. My name is Jim Dirtle, and I am the Workforce Development Associate Director with Goodwill Easter Seals. And Madam Chair, members, I'm honored to be here and talk to you today about our work with the SNAP E&T program, specifically around our effort Heading Home Employment Collaborative. This started as an employment committee in the Hennepin and Ramsey counties' plans to end homelessness. We worked together to develop employment as a strategy to end homelessness, and SNAP E&T has become a key part of this work. The Heading Home employment providers include Goodwill Easter Seals, Catholic Charities, Project for Pride in Living, and added this fall was Youth Link in Minneapolis. Our team provides job search assistance, individualized case management, occupational skills training, work experience, and support services, which are supported through the funding of SNAP employment and training. Our staff are co-located at the Adult and Youth Opportunity Centers, Youth Link, Minneapolis, Dorothy Day Center, and the Opportunity Center in Minneapolis. This limits the transportation barrier. These are one-stop shop models, and we have worked together to streamline processes to increase access to services. For example, we have a common orientation. Individuals can come in, receive services, and connect to really the networks of all three organizations through one location, one time. I think one of the key pieces with SNAP employment and training is the flexibility in program design, which we've been able to incorporate. So improve service flow, increase capacity as we leverage also the strength and expertise of all the supporting organizations. Together our work also addresses racial disparities and complex barriers to employment. 69% of those we serve are people of color, so therefore 31% are white, and for some challenges we see, 40% are unemployed for 6 months or longer, 46% have a criminal record, and again, 100% are those experiencing homelessness. At Goodwill Easter Seals, over the last 3 years, to share some of our outcomes, we have helped 180 individuals obtain employment for an average wage of $10.60 per hour. And these are individuals who were going and entering the program that had no income at the point of entering the program. And on average, they're working 35 hours per week. We see several opportunities for SNAP employment and training in Minnesota. It's been effective for us to reach underserved populations, in this case specifically individuals experiencing homelessness, but I think that can be applied more broadly across the state. It's been to integrate service systems and develop collaborations to meet the unique needs of various communities. SNAP employment training has been a really supportive funding base to help with being really creative with program design. And great opportunity to scale services up through SNAP ENT 50% funds. Minnesota has many great programs. The challenge is often getting them to scale and connecting systems to match employment challenges in our community, and SNAP employment and training can be part of that solution. And again, we're both here for questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you. And is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone. Member questions. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this could be dealt with in the Finance Committee, but I just at some point would like to get some information about the up to 10% of the funds can be used for administration for capturing this. If it's just a 50-50 split, it seems like that, you know, I'm not quite sure what the administrative costs are of obtaining that, if it's a formula. And then just some reassurance that the transfer to the general fund sounds fine until I looked at the language on 3.12 to 3.14, and it seems to imply that some of it is connected to child care assistance and MFIP, but I just want to understand how that works to just make sure we're not diverting money that right now we're using for those groups. It sounds like we're not.
Ms. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. The transfer that we're proposing in the bill would be hasn't happened yet, and it is a fiscal year 2017 transfer where DHS would transfer the money to the general fund from that they're receiving in this 50% reimbursement program from the federal USDA. So it's my understanding that it would not have an effect on the other pieces. It may just be the rider language that you're seeing reflected. But DHS is here. I'm sure they could speak to that. And clearly we can get you a crystal clear answer for the Finance Committee. The second part of your question, I believe, was about the kind of more about the mechanism of the 50%. And We think DHS will need a little bit of technical assistance to kind of ramp up this program. The Goodwill Easter Seals of the state and the colleges and the other nonprofit groups that are out there doing the work where they're serving SNAP eligible participants will need to submit some sort of invoice or receipt to DHS, who then serves as the pass through for this reimbursement. And it's a 50% reimbursement of funds. So if you spend $1,000 in an eligible manner on a participant, you would get $500 of that back. So DHS would serve as a pass-through to these other third-party local community organizations who are already investing money in training and supplemental services to these folks. The 10% is a recognition that there is going to be some work that has to be done at the department to really get all of what Minnesota should be getting. The other piece I just want to mention on this is the USDA has recently selected Minnesota as one of 10 states to receive some best practices and technical assistance help from based on the Washington State program, SNAP ENT program, which is really good news, and we think the USDA is very committed to building robust and effective job-driven SNAP ENT programs in the states, and so we think that's a great sign that Minnesota has been selected for that, and it's a positive sign of both the department's commitment to building this program and the potential that the state has.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think we should look at that in finance. I think it's great to grab as much federal money as we can to achieve our goals. At the same time, I think we're more used to seeing budgets for how many staff would it take to process this rather than a percent, since the percent may grow, the number of people trained, but the systems aren't going to grow that much more. And so maybe an administrative budget would be a better approach than just a flat percent.
Any other questions, members? Not seeing any. I will renew my motion that House File 3277, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Zerwas and Representative Dean.
He said no.
Representative Zerwas, being as you have a good part of the rest of the night, actually all of it, which bill would you like to take up next?
Madam Chair, you can pick the order. I've got them all up here.
Okay, just one minute then. Representative Zerwas, let's take up House File 2436.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, members. I will move House File 2436 be re-referred to...
Representative Zerwas?
My guess is HHS Finance?
Yes, Representative Zerwas moves that House File 2436 be recommended and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Zerwas, two-year bill.
I have a DE1. Madam Chair, I'll move that at this time.
Okay. Representative Zerwas moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Oh, excuse me. It's the DE1-1. Just to make sure that the record is correct. So Representative Zerwas moves
DE1-1.
The DE1-1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's an A1 amendment to the DE1-1. I'll move that at this time.
Representative Zerwas moves the A1 amendment. And I'll just make sure that members can catch up. But we'll have Representative Zerwas move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, two-year bill as amended.
Madam Chair, I'm going to start with several apologies. I apologize for my delay. I've always heard of HHS being hell and human sacrifice. I learned one very important lesson tonight. I don't know what Pension Commission stands for, but don't ever go there. So... That being said, I apologize for my delay. Holy cow. So I got that out of my system. I will never go back there. Last year, we had several dental bills and a lot of conversation around MA dental rates in the state of Minnesota. We had several dental bills both in the House and in the Senate. And at the end of the day, Madam Chair and members, as a part of the conference committee, as we got into the end of the conference committee, we had a certain amount of money set aside for whatever we wanted to do within the dental bucket. And we talked as a conference committee, and we had a motion, and it was our understanding that we would be taking that money to raise dental rates in greater Minnesota. And so what ended up occurring, Madam Chair members, is in the final language that went through for dental operations in greater Minnesota that filled in greater Minnesota. And so mobile units that traveled outstate but had their billing codes back within the metro area, were not impacted by that rate increase. And so the series of bills you're going to see are different options for correcting that billing scenario to the best of our ability. And so one of the bills deals with if we get additional money and bringing all the services up to the 9.65. Another one of the bills has us not getting any additional money and kind of reshuffling the deck for Greater Minnesota so that mobile units still get an increase compared to where they were a year ago. And then the third bill has a combination of the new money and a different approach for reimbursing dental screening that occurs on some of these outreach visits. And so that is the bulk of what we're going to see in the three dental bills. And I don't know if you want to take them one, two, three. Do you want to do testifiers on all three of them and then go with the presentation of the bills? That might be easier for folks, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Zerwas, why don't... So we have House File 2436 in front of us right now. So why don't we take testifiers on that bill? However, if they have comments they want to make kind of on the overall issue and how it relates to some of the other proposals, that's fine. But just so it's clear in members' heads what we're moving on at a time, I think it's best to just keep in mind what bill is in front of the committee, and then we'll go to the next one, and then the next one.
Perfect.
And obviously there's going to be overlap in conversation and issues that kind of are bringing all these bills forward. So with that, why don't we bring testifiers forward? Who wants to testify to House File 2436? Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, and just due to the late hour, members, we won't do time limits, but if we could just remember to keep our testimony as concise and to the point, both for testifiers as well as members of the committee, that will be great. So welcome to the committee. We appreciate you being here. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Sure. Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Wolcha, and I am the Executive Director of Children's Dental Services, which is a nonprofit dental clinic serving over 35,000 low-income children and pregnant women annually all across the state of Minnesota. The patients we serve are incredibly diverse, with over 80% being recent immigrants and refugees. Over 99% of those we serve have incomes below 200% of the federal poverty guideline, and over 80% receive medical assistance. 19% are uninsured and receive reduced cost or free care from us. Children's Dental Services is the single largest provider of dental care on-site within low-income public schools and Head Start centers, operating a hub-and-spoke model. So as Representative Zerwas described, our hub, our bricks and mortar, is located in the Twin Cities, but we send portable teams all over the state, and many of them actually reside in rural communities and house the equipment there and travel from their homes to do the care, but the billing comes out of our central location for a matter of efficiency. We rely on diverse dental teams, including mid-level oral providers like collaborative practice dental hygienists and dental therapists, again, to travel with the portable equipment and deliver high-quality care at a lower cost for children. Through our unique care model, we deliver oral health services all across the state, as I mentioned, and there's a map in your materials that shows, just to give an example, we're across central and southwest Minnesota, including Cottonwood, Isani, Jackson, Lyon, McLeod, Mille Lacs. Redwood, Rice, Wright, and many other counties encompassing St. Cloud, Moorhead, Bemidji, and northeastern Minnesota. So again, we're serving the kids, over 10,000 of them, in fact, annually, but not receiving the rate increase that was intended for low-income and rural families. And that's why we're here to bring your attention to what we think was a hiccup in the initial legislation and hoping for your correction of that. Thank you so much, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you for being here. And I'll see if there's other testifiers, and then if you could just stay nearby if there are any questions, that would be great.
Thank you.
Are there others in the audience who want to testify to the bill? Okay, not seeing any. Members, questions or comments? Representative Liebling.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm just kind of, we're sort of looking at the language here, and so I was looking at the original bill and at the DE1, and let me see if I've got the right things here, 2436. So when I was looking at the language in the original bill, it had language about the very last sentence in the bill had this language about requiring managed care and county-based purchasing plans to pass on the full amount. And it also says that the increase was to be reflected in payments to them, right, and that they were to pass it on. But the DE, I'm only seeing the language about increasing their rates, but not any language about requiring them to pass it on, unless I'm missing something here. Payments. So the language, Representative Loeffler is pointing it out to me, but the very last sentence here says, effective January 1st, 2017, payments to the health care plans and county-based purchasing shall reflect the payment increase. So that, to me, is just saying that the payment increase has to go to the plans, but we've taken out the language that says the plans have to actually pass on the payment increase. Maybe Mr. Chun can tell me that I'm missing something here, if you follow what I'm saying.
Madam Chair, Mr. Liebling, you are correct. There is a difference in the language, and it's as you described it.
Okay, so, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
So, Representative Zerwas, was that your intention? Because I'm not sure if, you know, it's great if we're going to then reflect the increase in the payments to the health plans, great for them, and the county-based purchasing plans, but are we requiring them to pass it on to the providers? I thought that was the intent here, or is that somehow going to happen without our saying so?
Representative Zerwas.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that is language that DHS suggested. I don't know if someone from DHS can come down and explain.
Representative Zerwas, we do have somebody here from the department who can come down and help clarify.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, DHS contacted me as they were helping with some technical assistance on the DE1, and they had a reason that made a lot of sense on the phone as to why we couldn't have that. Now, 3 months later, if I can remember that, but I think DHS can help me out.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Marquardt. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, my name is Julie Marquardt. I am the Director of Purchasing and Service Delivery at DHS. And as Representative Zerwas has indicated, this was language that we did recommend, not because we don't expect the increase to pass along. It's just that we don't generally give a dollar for dollar or a stated dollar increase. Some of our MCOs already pay well above the fee-for-service rate. So this is a fee-for-service increase that we will take into consideration when we do the managed care rate setting. And whatever we add to that, then the plans must consider where they are and their contracting with dental providers. And it may have more than a 9.65% increase to some dental providers. It may be a little less than that to some, depending on where they currently contract with their different providers.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Marquardt. So how are we assuming that we're able to allocate the extra money for this, how are we to know that it's going where it's intended to go?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, we can look at what they are paying to their individual dental practices, but at some point, we do not dictate the contract terms between the managed care organizations and their contracted providers. In fee-for-service, we absolutely set a dictated rate that must be that we pay. But because of the nature of certain practices, if there is certain volume going to certain providers, they may be willing to take a little less, but they get more patients directed to them. So we are allowing the payment to flow through, but certainly if a managed care organization did not pass any of it through, which I don't expect would happen, we would hear about that, and we would address that issue.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I mean, we're back in this conundrum that we always have that's just an artifact of the really backwards, in my view, way that we do our healthcare programs. I mean, this is the problem that we always have. And so, Representative Zerwas, maybe if we can't know that we're going to actually pass through the increase, I mean, all of our goal here is to increase access to services. And so I think the other way to do it, you know, so I've had this conversation with Ms. Marquardt and with the department many times. You probably have too. You know, we are contracting with HMOs to deliver a package of services. And if the patients who are in those programs are not getting the services, then I guess that doing something like what you're trying to do is not going to get us there. Maybe what we ought to be doing is saying, monitoring them and saying, you're not giving the services and you have to give the services that you are contracted to give. And then if they want to come back and say, we can't do it without X amount of money, maybe that would be the way to do it. But just to give them money to say, you know, we're going to increase your rates and hope that you're going to do something that's going to increase access, I think is maybe not a very fruitful way to do it. And I, you know, I'm fully on board with you in terms of what you're trying to do, but holy cow, I'm not seeing that this is going to get us there in light of what Ms. Marquardt is telling us.
And I just have a question following up on Representative Liebling for Ms. Marquardt. So am I understanding that on the original bill on line 3.9 where it says the commissioner shall require managed care and county-based purchasing to pass on the full amount of the increase in the form of higher payment rates, is it that what is wrong with that when the department gave Representative Zerwas technical support on his DE, what's wrong with that language? Is it not... we can't do that, it just hasn't been the practice. Could you comment on what's the issue with that language and making sure that that passes through to the providers?
Sure. Madam Chair, the language as it was originally written, I think, is we certainly understand the intent is whatever we increase should pass through. What we don't know yet is whether or not any increase to dental will materially impact the rates we pay to the managed care organizations. So let's say, for instance, because dental is only a small component of what we pay for the overall health care. So if, for instance, this ends up adding nothing to the capitation rate that we pay a managed care organization, the expectation here would be they pass along zero. And that's not the outcome we want. While we may say, hey, the dental rates and fee-for-service are increasing, we may not increase the capitation amount, but certainly we are making a statement that we want dental services, we expect some increase in dental services, particularly where we know that access has been problematic. And I just wanted to make a clarification that the MCOs are also subject to access standards that we have to monitor, that they have to monitor, that we do not have on the fee-for-service side. So they are accountable for access to care. That is independent of the rates they pay. Regardless of the rates they pay, if they aren't having sufficient access, increasing the rate may be a way that they use to improve that access if that's found to be problematic for them. So we don't want to create a potential where we're creating nothing gets passed along if that really is what the MCO thinks should be done.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zerwas, you've been in contact with one of my dental clinics in Alexandria, Caring Dental Hands. Would your piece of legislation fix the issue that they are having over in that facility?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, the DE1-1 is looping in mobile units, so it would not impact that.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. And just since we're all confused, Ms. Marquardt, both the DE and the original bill say that effective January 1st, 2017, payments to managed care and plans and county-based purchasing plans shall reflect the payment increase. So this changes your contract and the amount of money you're going to provide. Now we could, and so I don't understand why you wouldn't expect that that would flow through as intended in the dental bucket. Even if the plans might argue that they can't give a uniform percentage to everybody, every dentist in their contract because it doesn't reflect their contracting strategies. If the language that's here goes through, it says you are going to give them more money beyond what you contracted for. And should we put language in that says it can only be used for dental services?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, unfortunately, I know that's what people's perception of language like that is. The way that managed care rate setting goes is it's factored into, but the decision about whether rates increase in the aggregate, meaning overall the capitation rate, is an actual analysis that includes all the trend, the cost, the increases, and whether or not it moves the mark on is that adding $2 or $1, and how what you segment for what accounted for any of the increases, that would be a very complicated analysis. So we have always taken that things that are to be considered, when the legislature said this is not to be considered, that doesn't mean that the costs of different healthcare services aren't going up year over year over year, and that we still aren't increasing the capitation rate to reflect those costs. But when they say they don't want us to consider something, then we don't add that overt into the analysis, but it doesn't mean that the result is something goes up or down. So we've taken this as you must consider it in your analysis when you do rate setting for 2017.
Madam Chair.
No.
Representative Zerwas.
I would say I fully appreciate members' frustration. I am equally as frustrated was when I got the phone call, and quite frankly from the work that we did in conference committee with what we tried to do for dental services in Greater Minnesota, five attorneys looked at the language that we had out of that conference meeting with Senator Laurie, and four out of five attorneys agreed that it included mobile units. Unfortunately, the fifth attorney worked for DHS, so we were SOL. So here's where we're at. I think we know what we're trying to do. It's been a very, very arduous process to put the right words in a bill to get what we all know are trying to get at. And it's extremely challenging.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It reminds me of, I often say to my constituents that we don't pass sound bites. We pass bills that are oftentimes many pages long of legalese. But at the same time, I would say to Ms. Marquardt and DHS, we pass laws, not suggestions. If it was a suggestion, it would say the Department of Human Services shall consider such and such in establishing rates. Instead, the language is the department shall pass on these rates. And you just went through a rebidding. You just signed new contracts at the end of the year. And those contracts have set rates. And my understanding is that you can renew those contracts for another year. I've heard the rumor that you intend to do it for 2 years, but you left it open in the bidding to be able to do it longer. But there's nothing that I think says that you have to apply the exact same methodology that you used in negotiating those rates. And it's not just trend, it's also negotiation. I mean, it's a complicated process. But we really have to figure out a way to have a partnership between the legislature dedicating resources for particular undermet needs and have that flow through to all providers in a way that we can trust that our intent is followed, because we're responding to complaints about access, and or either that, or you have to get much more robust in your ability to monitor access in time and place for your enrollees and in enforcing the contracts. You know, there's a different route you can go, but I do think we really do need to work with you on a common understanding of how to get our intent implemented in all the aspects of the health system.
Members, other comments or questions? Okay, so members, and I understand we have two more bills that we're going to hear immediately after this one that are continue to try to get at the same issue. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Marquardt, if you can't draft language just adding this in, would you have somebody in the department draft language and then bring it back and tell us why we shouldn't do it, and then we'll consider whether or not we should do it? It seems very simple to put the language in that the providers will get all of the money, and then we can hear your arguments why it would and why it wouldn't be the proper way to do, and we'll decide. But I think we should have that. We are the legislature, and the governor is a part of this too, and I think that we should be able to make that decision, not leave it up to DHS as to whether or not it should be done, so that the providers will get the extra amount.
Representative Marquardt.
Representative.
Oh, excuse me, Ms. Marquardt. Excuse me.
Madam Chair, we can certainly provide. There are a small number of places where a dollar for dollar rate increase goes through. It's not something that's very commonly done, but if members would like to see what those examples look like, we can certainly provide that. I don't know if that's,
Madam Chair,
something you're open to.
Representative Zerwas.
I appreciate the committee's comments and support, and it echoes all my concerns from this winter when I first started with phone calls with DHS on some of the suggested amendment language for the DE-1-1 amendment, and I am certainly open to working on this, to making sure that the legislative intent is followed through as this bill moves throughout the process.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Marquardt, I just got a question. If the funding that the legislature appropriated for the rate increase isn't exactly going to the providers, where does the funding go?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, it still goes to provide. I mean, there's a certain amount that they can have for their medical services. They have a certain amount that can go to debt. I mean, there's a lot of ways that a company has with respect to their financial reporting, and we do get that. So there's a lot of places they spend their money. Most of it, the vast majority, is on healthcare expenditures. But for instance, if we have a managed care organization that is already paying twice the fee-for-service rate, they may say, we have adequate access, we are paying a sufficient amount of money to dental, but in mental health we need to make an investment. So they may decide that for this year they need to invest in mental health, where maybe they don't have as much access or as ready access as they would like. So they are still looking at their book of business of where do we want to improve access, where do we get it, because some MCOs have made investments in dental that are well above the fee-for-service rate. Others may not have.
Madam Chair,
Representative Zerwas.
Ms. Marquardt has convinced me to work with Representative Mallory and find a way to make sure this money goes where it intended to. Because at no point during the conference committee, when we set aside millions of dollars for rural dental care, was it so that MCOs could make up money for mental health care access. It was for rural dental access. And that's what we all agreed on in that conference committee. So an answer like that, Madam Chair, is just very, very frustrating.
Yeah. Representative Franson.
Well, I am just glad I asked that question. When visiting with my clinic in my district, it was posed to me how many roads and bridges would get built or fixed at the rate of that dentists get reimbursed for the current dental rates, and that Mississippi and Alabama pay better dental rates than Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
British.
Yeah. Representative Baum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerwas, can you enlighten me on the interdependence and interrelationship of this bill and 2437 and 2614? Because there appears to be similar language, and in fact, one of them has some dotted points.
Representative Zerwas.
Yep, Representative Guam has, as I stated as I was introducing these, there's three bills that are. Three different ways to approach this scenario with looking at access for mobile units. One is if we were going to get additional funding and take the mobile units up to that 9.65, I believe it is. Another bill looks at if we're not getting additional money, but spreading that increase out to include mobile units. And then the third option is doing the 9.65, but then also looking at the potential for reimbursing some preventative screening that's currently being done.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. Basically, since these are moving parallel, in my understanding that there are at least, two or three other committees, and as things become clearer budget-wise, and these are worked on and progressed, I think we'll end up seeing a unified bill, and I understand why these are going parallel. So I'm fine with progressing this to the committee structure, and as things solidify, the a single, all improved, wonderful bill might emerge. And I'm hoping we don't slow down the process, because we don't know which one will end up, making the cut.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that's, a pretty good suggestion, Representative Quam. And, I just wanted to sort of say that I think what we're experiencing is, we're encountering the wonderful PNAP system again. And this is a problem that, as long as I've been working in Health and Human Services, legislators have struggled with this system that we have. And so we have, I think, here a dual goal, and I would say that we probably all share it on this committee. And one is making sure that the people who are on these programs who are supposed to be covered for dental care actually can get the care. So that's one goal. And a second goal is to make sure that dentists are paid a rate that isn't embarrassing, mm-hmm. and that actually we know that they're going to be paid less than a commercial rate, but really, it's embarrassing to be down there 49th or whatever we are. So, I have two bills in right now, actually, both of them to get rid of our PMAP system. And I know that it's really a bipartisan issue. We've had, in the past we've had hearings on, where the HMO money goes. And I know that things are a little better now. I know the department's worked really hard to get some of the waste out of that system, and they have. But, I think I just would say to the committee that ultimately what we see here today is that as long as we have this system, that we, the legislators, don't have the control that we should have over this system that's costing billions of taxpayer dollars. So when you go home, Representative Franson, and you talk to that dentist, and you're on this committee, and you're, I think you're on finance too, aren't you? And they say, well, you know, you're spending billions of dollars. How come I can't make any money seeing these patients? And you go, I don't know. Right? Because what else can you really say? What else can any of us really say?
That point of a Nick Zerwas.
So, okay. You know, so... So my point is that the system that we have puts us in this position, and we're going to be in this position to some degree as long as we have this system. And then the other thing is that Representative Schultz here has said, you know, we could set a minimum rate for dentists. I suppose we could do that, couldn't we? We could say, if you're paying for a service, it's got to be X amount, minimum. And that might be one way to approach it. I don't know, but I just think we need to think bigger about how to, you know, I don't have the magic replacement. I've got a couple of bills in that have two different ways of replacing the system, but I think that that's really, to me, the ultimate direction that we need to go, because we're not, we're paying, we don't have any control over the rates, and we don't have any way to get the service to the people that need it, and we just have to be able to resolve this somehow. And I hope that before I retire, we'll do something, and we won't have to keep having the same basic hearing over and over again with the same issue.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I think, you know, if we were to look back at the last year's omnibus bill, is probably one of the areas that I would give the lowest grade on was our goals to improve dental access in rural Minnesota. You know, there was a lot of work that was done by groups outside to try to reach agreement, and unfortunately things didn't progress as well as we would have liked, and that's partly our responsibility, partly the responsibility of the folks outside, but the fact of the matter is that we didn't do very well, and I don't want to see this thing just get derailed. If we can improve rural health access for dental a little bit this year with some of these improvements, I'd like to see that move on. We are moving a little bit late in the game in a very, very short session, so I would like to see these bills move into the Finance Committee, and would encourage folks to continue to work together to try to find some common ground agreements that actually make sense out in the real world. So I would encourage you to move it along, and hopefully we can get some repairs, some bridge work, some facial repairs, and hopefully a little Novocaine for the Finance Committee.
Well put, Representative Dean. Not seeing any other comments or questions for this bill, Representative Zerwas will renew his motion that House File 2436, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. And Representative Zerwas, we will move to House File 2437. Representative Zerwas moves House File 2437 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Zerwas, I understand we have a DE1.
Madam Chair, we have a DE1-1.
A DE1-1. So, members, I will move, or Representative Zerwas, excuse me, will move the DE1-1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, there is an A1. No. Okay. Sounds good. Okay, so we do an amendment. We'll get to that in a minute. We'll have you speak to your bill first, and then if the author of the A1 amendment wants to move that, we'll take it up at that time. But right now, Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, members, and I'll be brief for the committee since we've had all of the talk about this, except the fact that in this version of the bill, we don't yet have a fiscal note for adding the mobile units, so we don't know what that additional cost will be. if that additional cost becomes prohibitive, I wanted an opportunity to look at taking that pot of money from last year and lumping in the mobile units. Now, that being said, I will quickly say ditto to all the concerns that were expressed in the last bill.
Okay, members, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Since Representative Mulry is out of the room, I could move the A1 amendment. And I can tell you that this is just to, as we're passing on good ideas to finance to wrestle with, what this one does is it makes it statewide, so it's both metro and rural, because we know that no dentists anywhere are getting enough money compared to other states and are still having challenges. And so that's the intent of that A1, is to get it to finance, so that the Finance Committee has a committee position that says we appreciate the work our dentists do. We know there's shortages of dentists and dental care for our public program enrollees throughout the state, and it would get it to the Finance Committee as another option.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, I want to thank Representative Mulry for having the amendment drafted, and Representative Loeffler for offering it. We took the A1 amendment in the last bill. Some may think that was by mistake. It was actually wicked tactical. I love it. I love it. I'd love to be able to come up with the money and be able to do that. And I think it's needed. As we look at Minnesota being 49th in dental rates in the nation and 50th with pediatric dental patients, the need is clearly there. However, with this bill, since we're not talking about an increase of funding, we're taking last year's appropriation but spreading it out over to possibly including mobile units, the A1 amendment in this bill, by spreading it statewide, would take what was a 9.65% increase in theory to about a 0.00019% increase. And so, Madam Chair, members, with that, this amendment just doesn't make sense for this bill. Okay. However, Representative Loeffler, anything I can do in the time that I'm here to increase dental reimbursement rates paid to dentists, I would be 100% for.
Well, thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be glad to withdraw the A1 amendment, since we have it on the other one and we are getting that discussion point happening. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Loeffler withdraws the A1 amendment. Members, to the bill, and I'll say, is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against House File 2437 as amended?
Okay,
not seeing anyone at this time. Members, any other questions or comments? Okay, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 2437 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thanks, Representative Zerwas. And the next bill, Representative Zerwas, House File 2614.
Madam Chair, members, last dental bill. I'll move House File 2614 be referred to Health and Human Service Finance. And there is a DE amendment for this one. It's the DE1.
Okay. So, okay, Representative Zerwas, I believe you intend to move the DE2 amendment?
Yes, ma'am.
So, members, Representative Zerwas moves the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, aye. No. The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, this has the rate increase similar to the first one, but the only difference that this has is with Section 1 under this bill, we're talking about the collaborative dental Minnesota law, we have collaborative, that's easy to say, dental hygienists that have special training and are granted authority by the Board of Dentistry to provide preventative cares in community settings outside a dental clinic or and under the supervision of a Minnesota licensed dentist. This bill provides for state program reimbursement for collaborative dental hygienists to serve patients in community settings, i.e. Head Start, who may not otherwise receive these preventative screenings. To ensure patients who need the follow-up care receive that necessary treatment, because that was somewhat one of the pushbacks that we got, is we don't want to start reimbursing for folks that just say, yeah, you have a problem, you have a problem, you have a problem, and not providing follow-up care and correct that problem. To ensure that we're doing that, the screenings must be done by providers who have established relationships with dentists and dental clinics to provide the needed follow-up care, and if they do not provide the follow-up care themselves. The bill also authorizes the commissioner to monitor whether or not the follow-up care is being provided to ensure that patients and families screened in the community settings become with a dentist, become connected with a dentist, and get that necessary follow-up care. So we want to make sure that this builds in accountability into reimbursement for any preventative screening. And with that, I do have a testifier, and I will turn it over to Ms. Erickson.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tara Erickson, and I represent Apple Tree Dental. It is a large nonprofit dental company. We have two metro clinics, and we also have four outstate clinics. And from there, we have our mobile dental units that go out into the community. Right now, we have over about 250 contracts, so we become the dental home in nursing homes, group home settings, and Head Starts. We just had Representative Loeffler, Lomer, out to the VA hospital not too long ago. We were doing some tours, and so she was able to see how we provide care on site for the residents there. And it's just a very, very good way to provide care for some of these populations. Want to talk about a little bit about we partner with the Minnesota Head Start Association. So we go in and we provide care on site in Head Starts. Most of these kids are absolutely do not have access to dental care. So the fact that we're going into these schools and we're doing these preventative screenings and we're actually only triaging the kids who need follow-up care. So what we want to be able to do now is obviously bill and be reimbursed for some of those screenings. We've been doing this for years, but we've never been able to get reimbursed for that. So this is going to be adding that. This is language that we have worked on with Children's Dental Services and the department. And this has been years in the making, so we're really excited if this possibly finally goes through.
Okay, thank you. And anyone else in the audience wants to testify for or against the bill?
Madam Chair, can I? I'm really sorry that we're having this much debate about the mobile units, because we actually did, we had to pull some data for us for Apple Tree, and it's about 9% of our mobile units that go out of the Twin Cities area are providing the care outside of the 7-county metro. So it's really not going to be a pretty big price tag for you guys, so I feel bad that there's been this much angst over the bill. Mm-hmm. But honestly, with the rates that we have here in Minnesota, every little bit helps, right, especially for these nonprofits who are providing this work. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Members, questions? Okay, not seeing any questions. Representative Zerwas, any other comments on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Zerwas will renew his motion that House File 2614 be re-referred to the committee, as amended, excuse me, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Okay, members, the next bill is House File 2665. Moving away from dental, changing topics a little bit. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Madam Chair, I'll move House File 2665 be referred and passed to Health and Human Service Finance.
Okay, and Representative Zerwas, I understand that you have an A1 amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. I'll move the A1 author's amendment.
Okay, members, Representative Zerwas will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, and I'll introduce it briefly and then take questions. But this is somewhat out of response to, as we've dug in to the Met system and the some of the decision-making process for that, we found out about this executive steering committee that's ranking IT priorities and making a lot of the decisions on what's worked on and how things are prioritized within MnSure and within DHS and the Met system. And so we had some questions about whether or not those meetings were open to the public and accessible. I did a data practice request looking at the minutes of those meetings, and we got reams of books of minutes where it's almost all redacted. So we found this pretty troubling and pretty concerning. And so as we've had some questions about decision-making process and how things are prioritized and how those decisions are working down, that really have pretty significant impacts. I brought a letter from my county board that I just happened to receive a while back with question after question about the technical priorities for the enrollment eligibility system and the communication system between folks with Sherburne County and the department. And we don't have access to that decision-making process as the legislature today. We can't attend those meetings. We can't ask questions. We don't know what's discussed at a meeting. And so we might be told what the eligibility timeline is for fixing enrollment eligibility, or might be shown a bar graph, but we have no insight or transparency into those discussions. And we think as those discussions continue to impact thousands and thousands and thousands of Minnesotans on public programs and MnSure, that those discussions ought to be open to the public, and those decisions ought to be transparent. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll have to take questions.
Okay, members, and I guess before we go to questions, is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone. Members, questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I hope we're going to get some testimony, because I think it's kind of important to understand. You know, I think that the impulse towards transparency is good. I think we should have a lot more transparency in what we're doing. But I think that we need to, you know, the bill is changing the makeup of the board, of the, what are we calling it, the committee. And, you know, maybe Representative Zerwas, maybe you could explain how you're changing the makeup of it and why you're making those changes. That would be something that you could maybe hear about.
Representative Zerwas.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, I know the biggest change would be removing the Commissioner of Human Services from the makeup of it. We feel that since the Commissioner of Human Services already sets on the MnSure board, that they're already involved in that process.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zerwas, if you were removing the, I thought you were removing the commissioner from the MnSure board. Isn't that what you're doing? So that's,
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
I may have flipped that around. We're removing the commissioner from the MnSure board, I believe, is the plan, because they're already on the executive steering committee.
Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the executive steering committee is the thing that we're calling METS. It's just so we're talking about the same thing, right?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, I believe that's what they're calling METS,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, Madam Chair, if I could continue. So you're also changing the structure of this executive steering committee. that has been working kind of informally. So I guess I don't know why we're not getting any testimony here about this. Maybe it's too late at night, but I'd certainly like to hear from some of the participants what they think about this, because, you know, none of us, since, as you say, we're not sitting there, we don't know how this is working. And I don't really understand why you're changing the structure of that. I get why you're taking the commissioner off the miniature board, but why are you then, changing the structure of
Madam Chair. Yeah, Representative Zerwas, and I'll have you answer, and then maybe if whoever, it looks like, I mean, we do have some people here from either the department and Minsher, if they could come down and maybe help tease out the difference between the Executive Steering Committee and METS. My understanding is METS is the operating system, which has been confusing for a while because METS is nowhere. That was kind of a term that it's not in language or statute anywhere, but I understand that's what the operating system is called. And then this is creating officially the Executive Steering Committee.
Yep.
And the Steering Committee is who makes the priority decisions of how METS is operated.
Yeah.
But if we could have testifiers speak to that, Representative Zerwas.
Just briefly, basically, as we kind of dug into this, Madam Chair and members, as we found out, there's basically been an ad hoc leadership group that's been meeting behind closed doors, invite only, with a very few select group. There's been copious minutes and notes taken, most of which have not been made available to us as we've requested. A lot of it has been redacted. And so what this bill aims to do is put that Executive Steering Committee in statute and explain who exactly, as we understand, would serve on that committee, also adding someone from the Association of Minnesota Counties, since so much of their work and their technology prioritization impacts counties so directly, and then says that those meetings would fall under the purview of the open meeting law. But I could turn it over for some other testifiers. I want to comment on the current structure and how it's done and why. Just kind of explain where we're at right now.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself, and if you need the question repeated or clarification, otherwise, if you could just proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Marcus Schmidt, Director of Government Affairs for Minsher.
Madam Chair, committee, Patrick Carter from DHS.
And Representative Liebling, if maybe you want to restate some of the points of clarification you were looking for.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So, I just thought that we should have some comments on this bill from those who are affected by it. So maybe you could just explain who's on the Executive Steering Committee right now and whether you are, what your different agencies' responses are to the proposal here.
Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, the Executive Steering Committee currently is comprised of members from Minsher, DHS, Minute, and a representative from the counties. Those individuals who participate in the weekly meetings are Allison O'Toole with Minsher, Katie Burns with Minsher, Chuck Johnson with DHS, Nathan Morocco with DHS, Scott Peterson and Greg Poling with Minute, and Deb Huskins with Hennepin County.
Mr. Schmidt.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, in terms of the structure and the governance of the committee, I think I would probably refer the question to DHS, my colleague here who's representing Assistant Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, Representative Liebling. So unfortunately, Chuck Johnson isn't available tonight, but we've reached out to Representative Zerwas to kind of talk through some of these questions that Representative Liebling and others are raising. So we're hopeful to have a meeting with him later this week to discuss those concerns.
Okay, and I guess I'll ask, and I had asked this in a meeting of Ms. O'Toole last week or the week before, but can either of you speak to whether or not, in fact, the Executive Steering Committee is subject to open meeting laws? And if not, why not? Mr. Schmidt.
Madam Chair, I do believe that correspondence was sent to you and the committee from DHS regarding that specific question. And the determination from the legal counsel that was involved in the process determined that the structure of the ESC as it stands now is not subject to open meeting laws, but the correspondence does go on to state that all the parties involved are very open to discussing more at length with Representative Zerwas, members of the committee, about ways to address some of your questions around transparency and accountability and the activity that's going on there.
Okay, and I did receive that correspondence and appreciate it, thought it would be beneficial for the sake of the committee to understand where we're at. And I guess if I could just ask, does Minsure or DHS take a position on this bill or moving towards subjecting the Executive Steering Committee to open meeting laws, or are you neutral on the issue?
Madam Chair, currently our board has not. No, it's okay. Sorry. Currently, our board has not taken a position on this issue, but I do think that the letter speaks to discussions around the issue in terms of its openness and willingness to work with members of the committee and others on making this more workable for everybody.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Zerwas, and there's two very different things going on. One, you just added on to the amendment, and that is taking off the Commissioner of Human Services from the Minsure Board. And Minsure, the majority of enrollees in Minsure are public enrollees. The majority of the funding for it comes from public services, because by state law they have to pay the portion of the costs that are connected with people on MA and Minnesota Care. So why would we take off of the board the person who's looking out for the financial interests of the budget that our finance committee is in charge of?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, and I think it's that question right there, Representative Loeffler, that kind of confuses me, because when we have them in committee, they say, no, that's not really Minsure. When we're talking about the public programs, that's METS. That's METS.
Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
I think, respectfully, Representative Zerwas, that question you probably asked was about the technology and who owns what piece of technology. But the Minsure Board is a policy-setting board, and it sets an annual budget that comes to us. I think it's been submitted, or it will be, for our review. I seem to remember hearing that at a recent point this session. And so to me, it's important to have someone representing the largest share of the employees and the state budget that goes into the operations of Minsure, both in terms of its, you know, because it's a gateway to private coverage and a gateway to public. And we have it in state law that we're on the hook, the state, for the public share of the shared services. Then there's computer systems, and if it's determined based on after you've entered all your financial information that you might be eligible for a public program, then you go into METS. But all the stuff before you get to that point is a shared responsibility, because most people don't know. Do I qualify for Minnesota Care? Do I have to buy a private plan? They don't know. They put the numbers in, and it tells you which way to go. And so that shared responsibility is split, and I think we, as people who work on the DHS side of the budget, need to have someone who's connected to that budget sitting at that table when they're putting together their budgets and their plans. And so that, to me, is a governance issue. So that's a concern that I have. The other concern I have is that while you say you want more transparency, you've actually cut the number of people who are participating almost in half, from 7 to 4. So you're actually concentrating power. And if we lose one of the people who really knows this stuff because they get a better job offer from California or somewhere else, there's not that continuity. I always kind of think when you put together somebody who's in charge of operational systems, you want some redundancy and understanding the path forward. And so cutting it almost in half, to me, actually makes it a weaker group. rather than a stronger group. So I would really respectfully ask that you rethink and give some serious thought about that as you're discussing it with others. And the last thing I would say, that if you look on page 3, you're establishing, I think, some amazing precedents in state governance and in state government operations. And I would like this bill to be referred to the Government Operations Committee. We do not, and as far as I'm aware of, and I carried a bill under the unsession, remember Governor Dayton's unsession, and I had the honor of sitting through the evaluation of every advisory committee, every council, every commission, and I got to carry the bill that got rid of redundancies and eliminated a bunch of them, and there was not a single one of them that had these kind of provisions that says where they have to meet, says that they have to be on the legislator's website, even though it's an administration function. I mean, that's a crossing administration legislative, and really provides, you know, some really strong direction that I think is unprecedented. And it may even violate some constitutional separation of the branches of government. And so I know your goal is transparency, but I think you've almost made them a legislative subcommittee by your requirements, and I don't think that was your intent. But I think this raises really serious issues of governance, and the Government Operations Committee did set up the structure for MNSURE. I think it is under their purview to review that as well as the new requirements for a state advisory group. And so I really would recommend that the next, that the motion be amended to be that it goes to government operations before it comes back to finance.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, so I hear your concerns. I think some of them are well-founded. I think the challenge was finding that appropriate balance as we reached out for basic information about when the committee meets, where it meets, who's in attendance, what decisions are made, and then ask for minutes and other things. It was such a difficult process to get that basic information, leading then subsequently to a data practice request, that we felt like, you know, did we get a little aggressive in saying where and how they should meet? You know, I might tip you to that, but I think this group is making huge, huge decisions, and it's not the Legislative Oversight Committee making those decisions. It's not the MNSURE board that's making those decisions on IT projects and ranking and process and what workaround is going to be developed next and what interaction with the counties going to be done next. It's this group that meets on a weekly basis. That is the function of this group. And so we thought that since this is impacting counties in every corner of the state, metro counties to rural counties, and every resident on public program, and many, many residents that have tried to utilize the exchange, that we needed to go as far as we could for accountability and transparency, and that's how this bill got crafted. Now, as we work forward and continue to work with the department on crafting language that gets us in compliance with open meeting laws and some transparency, do I expect this bill to look significantly different in the coming weeks? Representative Loeffler, I do. I do expect it to look different.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
I still believe that the next stop needs to be government operations because it really has some issues that need to be worked out, and they're the experts on that issue. But I think it has some real ramifications for us as well. And, you know, I can't support taking the commissioner off of the MNSURE board when we are responsible for so much of what happens there fiscally and policy-wise. And to take away the voice of the Health and Human Services system from that board would be a real, really great loss that I don't think would be in the best interest of the state or any of the people served by MNSURE, particularly those on public programs.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for MNSURE. Why was the steering committee created and when was it created?
Mr. Schmidt.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I have been at MNsure for about 4 weeks, and I am not quite sure the origin of the ESC, but I am happy to talk to my colleagues and make sure that the committee gets that information in terms of when it was started and why.
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair and members, we had a very good committee hearing in finance regarding the structure of MNsure and how MNsure funds itself. And the way that the structure is currently set up does not provide adequate oversight for the general public to know what they're paying for and what their obligations are. Minnesota taxpayers should understand what they're getting for their money and who voted for it and when. The way that MNsure creates its budget is behind closed doors within a steering committee. Its appropriations are not capped and they are not appropriated. So if you like giving up your power to the governor and his agencies and his commissioners, then continue on as things are going right now, because you are signing away your legislative authority and responsibility to an agency. And now that agency has said that we can have a steering committee that doesn't subject itself to the open meeting laws, make fiscal decisions about budget, and then just pass a bill off to DHS because there's people on public programs, totally uncapped. Now, if you think that that is a good use of your election certificate in oversight of a public program, then I think you should talk to your constituents, because that is exactly the kind of thing that is driving up our costs and pulling responsibility and accountability away from the people. This is public example number one of why people are so ticked off right now. And if you haven't guessed right now, I'm probably going to focus a little bit on this as we go forward. I really think that Representative Zerwas is on the right track of at least opening up the door to the back room so we can see what the heck is going on back there if we are going to give up our ability to have oversight. At least we can see into the back room from here. So I would strongly encourage us to move forward with this.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And frankly, with the public programs, public funds, public etc., I'm surprised that there's such a cone of silence, and it seems reminiscent to undisclosed location and, you know, secret society type stuff. And if all this is public related, then frankly it ought to be publicly accessible information and knowledge and understanding, and I'd be less concerned about the loss of some of those, you know, seven, having listened to multiple counties with issues of how things got worse instead of better. Constituents have issues and etc. That's sort of unprecedented, and frankly I would not be surprised as to why people are trying to shake things up when it doesn't work and doesn't seem to have an end in sight. And at least we know that that, you know, back room is at smoke-filled because DHS is involved, but we don't know much else. And we can really, we should be able to really agree that this is important, and having the people have access is important, and to play games about not discussing the open meeting law opinion and saying, well, we sent you a letter, well, let the people that are listening, the people in the audience, know what their opinion of being open, instead of, you know, hiding it in correspondence that you refer to but won't speak of in detail on the committee. So, you know, frankly, I'm for shaking it up, because we need to shake it up and try and get something that is energized and working, or at least trying to let the people know that they're what they're doing and why. So I'm voting for this.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schmidt. So currently, as you described the makeup of both the MNSHR and the Executive Steering Committee, DHS has a voice on both those committees. Would that be correct?
Mr. Schmidt.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the way that the Executive Steering Committee is comprised does include representation from DHS, and the way that the MNSHR Board is comprised does involve representation from DHS.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Schmidt, who is that representation on those two boards from DHS?
Mr. Schmidt.
Madam Chair, Representative, the representation from DHS on the ESC is Chuck Johnson and Nathan Morocco. And the participant on the MNSHR board is Commissioner Emily Johnson Piper.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And understandably, it's, you can see the conflict, I hope you can anyway, that you have both Mr. Johnson and the executive director for MNSHR, who was the DHS representative at MNSHR?
The
commissioner, who they report back and forth, one reports to the other, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Schmidt.
The commissioner of DHS serves on the MNSHR board, and two assistant commissioners serve on the executive steering committee. And I assume that those two individuals do report to the commissioner, although I am not employed by DHS.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
So, would you think that there would be a conflict of interest for DHS to have representation on both boards?
Mr. Schmidt.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do not think that I'm in a place to speculate on a conflict of interest based on my experience at MNSHR. I do know that the way that the board structure was set up upon its founding required that the Commissioner of DHS serve on that board, and that the Executive Steering Committee, per the question of Representative Dean, originated at a time that I will report back to the committee with the information about that question. And I think that would help inform your question, Representative.
Representative Albright.
I think what we have here is a sense of the frustration that has been vented by representatives around this table ad nauseum on a number of occasions. It's a bit to, you know, it's akin to, in using legislative terms, you know, placing a House member on the Senate side of a conference committee. You're not getting fair representation, and you're not getting impartial representation. You're making executive decisions that are, to some extent, akin to backroom deals in the middle of the night. And we've heard that at, you know, in other Smoky. Well, it's DHS. The manner in which you evade the questions, and I appreciate that, you know, you're not answering questions for probably sake of others that are telling you to do that. But I really, really hope that you send a message back to the people that you report to that we really need some answers, and we're demanding them, and we'll get them one way or the other.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, I thank Representative Albright. That's a little bit unfair to a person who's been on the job for 4 weeks, and here we are, and it's 20 minutes to 9, and the fact that he doesn't have other people here in the room, you know, I think he's doing his best to not speak beyond what his knowledge is. So that's all I think is going on. I don't think he's trying to hide anything. I think that's a little too personal and a little unfair to him. But I wanted to comment on a couple of things. First of all, you know, the budget that Representative Dean was talking about, the budget being set somehow where it isn't, nobody sees what's going on. As I understand it, the budget for MNSHR, the organization, is set by the board of MNSHR, which is an open body, which is covered by the open meeting law, and this is done, as I understand it, in public. And maybe Mr. Schmidt can tell me if I'm mistaken, but, you know, there's nothing secretive about that. It's being set by a board. Secondly, Representative Dean referred to DHS having an uncapped appropriation. That's not true. Where's the uncapped appropriation? As I've said at least twice in public, those of you who were on the conference committee appropriated funding very appropriately. Whether it was appropriate for it to come out of the Health Care Access Fund or not, I don't know. That's up to you, but that's what you did. It's a capped appropriation. It's in the bill. It was appropriated for the use of this technology system for DHS to do its piece of that. And so to say that they have an uncapped appropriation they're dipping into is just plain old false. So we've got that piece. Now, you know, Representative Loeffler, I think, maybe misspoke a little bit. Here's how I understand this METS, and I have sat with the folks who do this and tried to understand this so that, you know, they have a clear idea of where this thing is going. So you've got MNSURE, the board of the organization that's called MNSURE, which is more than just technology, right? You've got a call center. You've got people who assist, you've got other functions. You've got the advertising function that people love to hate. You've got a lot of pieces of this that are MNSURE. METS, as I'm understanding it, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, METS refers to the technology. So when you go in through the door of MNSURE, you're in METS, and I think this is where maybe Representative Loeffler misspoke. METS is the piece that you put in your information, and it directs you one way or the other, and you're in this system. So this METS system has to be a jointly governed thing because it's got these different pieces that are all coming together. So, you know, I'm not adverse to the idea of having more transparency on this thing. I'm really not. And I bet you that if the folks who are doing this got together and we all talked about it, you know, I think it's not unreasonable to have some more transparency. I'm kind of a little bit wondering why things were redacted in the minutes. I'd like to get that question answered, certainly. Mm-hmm. I don't think this gentleman is going to be able to answer that question tonight. But I'd like that answer, too. But the idea that there's something nefarious going on here and that there's some kind of conflict of interest, I don't see any conflict of interest here at all. I see the same interest. You know, Representative Loeffler is absolutely right. We have an interest in this MNSURE thing as a state. Now, some of you don't like it and you want to bash it whenever you can, but it is indeed something that we need a representative on. And, you know, I guess I want to know from Representative Zerwas, you know, if, you know, I guess I'd like to make a motion to strike this part of the bill that was in the A1 amendment between lines 1.20 and 1.23, which is the part that takes off the commissioner and puts on somebody who's just a person from the general public instead. Because I think that would be a real mistake to take off our representation. I mean, you know, the representation from a person who represents such a big interest. So I think that would be a mistake, Representative Zerwas, and I'd really like to know if you'd be willing to do that at this point, because that, you know, I'm certainly willing to talk about having this become a formally structured body in some way, and I think I have a bill on that too, and maybe some other people do too, but that's certainly something that should be discussed, but to take the commissioner off of the MNSURE board, I just don't think it, I think it should be even discussed separately. I don't think it belongs in this bill. And so I guess I'd like to see what you, so I'm making that motion, and I'd certainly like to hear what your response to that would be.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, and Representative Liebling. I understand your concern with that being added in as an amendment you know, at this point, we have the amendment added on at this point, and I think as we move forward, I'd like to get a chance to visit with DHS and with Minshew, and I think we're going to be able to find compromise language as a whole to readdress that and some of the transparency and governance issues. So at this point, I would oppose that motion, but I think in the end, we're going to get to a situation where we're going to provide a lot more accountability. The reality is, members, just real briefly, actually, we can cover that motion, and then I can provide some final thoughts on the rest of the bill.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And staff has just informed me that the way it would really be to remove the A1, to strike the A1 amendment. It's the whole amendment. So I would make the motion to strike that, and I would ask for a roll call on that amendment.
Okay. So Representative Liebling is moving to strike the A1 amendment from the bill. Having requested a roll call, there will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Mack?
No.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Allen? Representative Backer?
No.
Representative Baker?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Franzen?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Kelly?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Blomer?
No.
Representative Mason?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Mullery? Representative Pearson?
No.
Representative Quam?
Yes.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Schultz?
Yes.
Representative Zerwas?
No.
There being 7 ayes and 12 nays, the motion does not prevail. Next person, we have a question from Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to respond a little bit to Representative Liebling, I do think that it is important to understand the relationship with the Minshew Board, their budget, the steering committee, and the legislature. There was an assertion put out that there was somehow funding for this uncapped appropriation within the conference committee, which is absolutely false. It was requested by the governor. It was rejected. There was not one word, not one letter, or one punctuation mark in the bill relating to that. Yet there's somehow this understanding that that Minshew can help itself to funds, state and healthcare access funds and general funds for its operations, pointing to an interagency agreement between one agency and another. And it is absolutely uncapped. There is no cap whatsoever. There was financial decisions made within the steering committee that we talked about on record and in committee that were inaccessible to legislators or anyone else. The interagency agreements are uncapped, and they do not relate to a spreadsheet number that you can point to. And you can say, I, Tina Liebling, voted for or against this appropriation. That's not right. We shouldn't be doing that. That, I believe, is inappropriate. And there is no cap to our interagency agreements. And I'm unaware of any other instance where we give away our legislative oversight to budget to a governor who doesn't get what he wants, so he just rewrites his budget by having one agency send another agency a bill. We don't do that anywhere else. And we don't do that within our public programs. And I would encourage members to read General Accounting Office recent report on state-based healthcare exchanges, in which the General Accounting Office looked at states, including Minnesota, and the need for increased oversight over their budgets, because our healthcare exchange is supposed to be self-sufficient. That is, it's supposed to generate enough revenue for itself to exist. That was one of the Obamacare rules put in place, so that they wouldn't grow like a grizzly bear cub you bring home and eat you out of house and home. That's why they put constraints on that. We are saying that you can go ahead and ignore that law, and you can go ahead and bill DHS and our healthcare access fund whatever you need, times 0.9. If we say that 90% of the people in Minshew are on a public program, you can just go ahead and send them a bill for whatever you want. There's no cap. That's an uncapped appropriation that you didn't vote for. So I'm going to really be looking at this more in depth, and I hope we all do as this moves forward. That's, I think, a discussion that we need to have more of, and hopefully we will. But Representative Zerwas's bill, from getting more sunlight onto the Executive Steering Committee, at least lets us have another peek into what's going on over there from our perch on the branch of this tree.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to ask for a roll call.
Roll call being requested. There will be a roll call on the bill. Other comments or questions, members? Okay, not seeing any. Representative Zerwas, final word on your bill.
Yeah, just briefly. You know, Madam Chair. Oh, Madam Chair, I think Representative Loeffler does.
Oh, thank you, Representative Zerwas. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I earlier made a motion that it be referred to the Government Operations Committee, and I don't think we've acted on that.
Okay, excuse me, Representative Loeffler. I heard you made the comment, did not catch the actual motion that you were making. So Representative Loeffler is making the motion that this bill be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Before that, Representative Zerwas, do you have any comment on that motion?
Madam Chair, members, I think as we meet in the coming week, I think we will be able to alleviate a lot of the concerns Representative Loeffler raised in cooperation with coming up with a little bit different tact on trying to get the transparency that we're looking for. I would be concerned about deadlines if we send it to Government Operations, because I know that it's their committee is absolutely swamped.
She's amending his motion.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is very clearly a government operations bill. It's changing the structure of an advise and creating an advisory committee, which in the rules of the House has to go to government operations. It's changing the makeup of a board, which is also within their jurisdiction. The original Minshew bill had to go to government operations because it had these provisions in. And I think we can avoid a rules fight on the floor if we just send it to them. And you can continue to work with others. But I think, per the rules of the House, this is where it needs to go first.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
She convinced me, Madam Chair. She's real convincing.
Representative Quam, did you want to comment on this?
Just clarification. So what's happening is the motion that the author's making is going to be amended or changed to where it's being referred, because we haven't actually referred it anywhere. Is that correct?
That is correct, Representative Quam. So Representative Loeffler will make the motion that the bill be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Madam Chair?
Representative Loeffler?
I think since the author agreed to it, and I think he can make the motion to, as part of his motion, to move the bill forward.
Okay. I don't know if it so much matters either way unless Representative Zerwas makes that statement as what he wishes. As of right now, Representative Loeffler, it is your motion.
Fine.
But understanding that Representative Zerwas is okay with it. So all of those in favor of the motion to re-refer this to government operations, please say aye.
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 Those say no?
No.
The motion prevails. Members, I believe there were no other comments. I'm sorry, Representative Loeffler, that I missed you there. So back to Representative Zerwas on your final comments on the bill.
Madam Chair and members, I guess I'll be brief, but I'll point out that a few bills ago, we talked about dental and dental reimbursement rates and what the legislature can have an impact on being able to tell DHS, we want this exact amount in a dental reimbursement rate to come forward in legislation. And Representative Mullery and Representative Loeffler and Representative Liebling were pretty upset that we didn't have direct control in that instance on how money was being appropriated and how a reimbursement rate was being set. I shared their frustration. And Madam Chair, I share the frustration, and this time of apparently only my Republican colleagues who are upset at not a $5 million appropriation for rural dental, but in excess of $300 million that we've put forth in Minshire in developing the health care exchange and now the administration of it. So I wonder, what could possibly be the difference between the two bills? I just wonder, members. Please support the bill.
Okay, members, with that, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 2665, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Governmental Operations and Elections Policy. There has been a roll call requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Mack?
Yes.
Representative Mullery? Representative Albright?
Aye.
Representative Allen? Representative Backer?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Yep.
Representative Dean?
Yes.
Representative Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Franzen?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Kelly?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Loeffler?
No.
Representative Lohmer?
Yes.
Representative Mason?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Pearson?
Yes.
Representative Quam?
Oui.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Schultz?
No.
Representative Zerwas?
Members, there being 15 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails. Okay, members, that concludes our agenda for today, and so we will be back here tomorrow for our regularly scheduled committee time. And with that, members, we are adjourned.